First order of business is approve the minutes from the last meeting. Anybody have any changes or somebody like to make a motion to approve? We get a second?
Second
by John Bello. Any objections? Seeing none, do we have a...
No objection, but you don't have a quorum.
That's what was my next question.
Certainly do in the audience tonight. Thank you for coming.
Yes, please. Yes, thank you very much.
One more.
Anybody know what traffic was like from the bridge?
It wasn't good, but it wasn't all that bad.
Ernie, he's coming from way up the coast, so I'm hoping he's just a little late. We hear from anybody that
no
was...
No one called, no one sent an email, so... Oh, Ernie did. Pardon. Pete is here for a substitute. Pete's here for Scott.
So Ernie's not coming. Well, Captain?
Can we pick somebody to serve as his proxy?
No.
I can vote twice.
Well, I suggest that you just proceed.
All right, we'll do that.
You know, go through these first agenda items and to let everyone know that it is that time of year when COVID is on everyone's mind, but we have other things to bring forward first. That have been in the waiting process.
All right.
And then again, depending on what the plans are of the chair for later on, we are hoping for COBIA. When Ryan presents COBIA, we're going to have a March 28th public meeting. So usually we have a follow-up COBIA meeting since we now have done it for 2 years in a row. I guess that makes a record. But so stay with us, and we'll go over some items first. And then maybe a seventh person will show up.
That sounds like the only choice we have. Okay, the first thing is Hall Saints, then. Is that correct?
Yes, we've got Captain George Martin's here. He's ready to make his presentation. Captain Martin presented to the commission last year. I don't remember the month, but March. So just about a year ago. And it was a little confusing at the time because I thought Captain Martin was talking about striped bass, but he was really talking about largemouth bass and hall seining. So I'll leave it to you to sort of go over your presentation and your recommendations.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, my name's Captain George Martin. I am a U.S. Coast Guard licensed 50-ton master's captain. I'm also a Maryland guide, licensed guide, a Potomac River Fisheries Commission licensed charter captain. I'm also the owner of a company called GMCO Maps and Charts. I'm also a working towboat U.S. captain. I'm not doing this to impress you. I'm just letting you know how many days a year I spend up on that portion of the tidal Potomac River. I'm basically talking the upper portion from about Aquia Creek north up to the Wilson Bridge. What I want to discuss tonight is about the Virginia tributaries. That was one of my challenges when I first brought up this subject, was who had jurisdiction. And this is in Virginia tributaries. It's in outside of PRFCs, and it's not in Maryland waters. They both agree on that. The problem we have up there is that the hull seining that's taking place in the spring, and I'm talking basically the end of March, April, May, and early June, is happening where the commercial fishermen are coming in the shallow waters. I'm talking from the shore out to about 3 to 4 feet. That time of year, we have two things mainly happening. One, we have the aquatic vegetation, the SAVs, are emerging at that time, which we know up in that area that's very, very important to the ecology of that whole fishery and to that waterway. The other big thing during that time of the year is that's the heavy largemouth bass spawning areas. Now, understand the commercial guys are in there. I know they can legally catch the catfish, the yellow perch, the snakehead, et cetera, and the carp. And gosh, catch all the blue cats you want. I'm all in favor for that. But what happens in this when they go ahead and pull these hull seines through, and again, bringing this up to the Black Bass Advisory Subcommittee in Maryland and talking to a couple of the commercial captains on hull seining over there, these hull seines are 960 feet long and can be as deep as 12 feet. When they pull them across these shallows, the 1, 2, 3, and 4 foot of water, I know they're not sitting there trying to harvest largemouth bass. They are caught up in the nets, and they are required by law to release them. Well, anybody that's been bass fishing in this area, you know if you catch a right before spawn or a post-spawn bass, you put it through that trauma, chances are the mortality of that fish is going to be pretty high. The other thing about it, it's destroying the bass beds in that area, both the ones that have just been created, the eggs, and the ones from the previous spawn when you have the fry in that area. They go to this grass for cover. That's all destroyed, that's chopped up, that's pulled up. I can't believe the fry has much chance of surviving. One of my other things, guiding in that area, I have documented where I've taken clients out, and in these areas before hull seining, easy for a non-fishing client to catch 25, 30, 35 bass in a 4 to 5 hour trip. After the hull seining takes place, we're lucky we catch 4 to 5. So again, this affects my livelihood and the destruction of the SAVs. One of the things up there that we try to go after is wherever we can find milfoil. That's a native grass up there that's highly productive and it's highly sought after for the bass both to spawn in and to live around and this fry to survive in. After the hull seining, I've had grass beds, milfoil grass beds, basically are gone. What comes up next in June is the hydrilla, which takes over, and we have no milfoil left in that area. It gets choked out with hydrilla. That's the problem we're having with it. What I'm recommending for certain remedies that would help, again, I'm not against the commercial guys. I'm not against hull seining. But when they come in there and they're destroying both the ecology and the fishery, it's affecting us, and it's going to affect them down the road. One, I think Virginia's regulations state that they can't do it in less than 3 foot of water unless they're using it to retrieve their catch. Well, this whole thing is being done in less than 3 foot of water. The other thing I do believe is that there's a regulation they cannot disturb SAVs. I can show pictures up here that I have where, let's see. This is one of the areas right here in the back of Belmont Bay. This is happening. I've witnessed it in Aquia Creek, Napsco Creek, Occoquan Bay, Belmont Bay, and the waters in front of what we call the Refuge Creek up in Holloman Point and in Pohick Bay. As you can see, these depths there, this is one of our GMCO maps, but that's taken directly from either the NOAA charts or when we've done actual surveys out there. And you can see that basically at low mean water, this area is at 2 to 3 foot depth throughout those flats. These were taken from the photographs from the first week of June when I was in there literally with a client on a bass guide trip. One of the things that got me, and again, I'm very proactive about this, is that that's the grass. In first of June, you should not see grass broken away. You can also see it's quite green. And this was surrounding us where we were. No, that is not a natural happening on the river at that time of year. So they're destroying the grass. But one of the things they came up with is what they're doing, and I believe in Virginia as well, they can do a single boat hull seine with one net, and they can have an assistance of another boat to help harvest catch. What's a practice that they're doing up there, while one of the boats pulling out the net, when they fully get it extended, the harvest boat will then race back and forth, or we nickname herding, back and forth across there, pushing the fish toward the net. Again, he's doing this in a major skiff in 2 to 3 foot of water. And again, he's destroying the SAVs as he's doing it. I had to leave the place we were fishing, which we were there first before they even started their operation, because how close the boat that was doing the herding was coming to us. It was not even safe. And we had to leave. Because one, part of me, being a townie and being local up there for a number of years, I would have probably gone ahead and dressed them and gone after it. I did not want to get in a conflict with a client on my boat. I didn't think that was the right thing to do at the time or a professional thing to do. So that's why I took these photographs, and I did forward this to the VMRC's law enforcement. I was told later that after they researched it, that they said there was no violation, which I have a hard time. And I believe after sending this information to Mr. O'Reilly, he actually even stated that according to the information that's supposed to be supplied to VMRC, they said there was no hull seining operation taken in these places last year. I can go ahead and probably get signed statements from about 15 to 20 other fishermen that were also affected by this. So what we'd like to see about doing is changing a couple things. One, make sure that shallow water hull seining in this area cannot be done in less than 5 foot mean low water, low tide. The reason we picked 5 foot is after talking to John Odenkirk, which is a biologist with the Virginia Game and Inland Fisheries in that region, concurs that is a major spawning area of bass on this region of the river. They spawn in 5 foot and less. So we're looking to protect that. The other thing that we would go ahead and we'd have these regulations in to match what Maryland already has for the bass fishing in there, since they consider this an important time of year, the March 1st to June 15th date. That's when they impose special regulations on the bass fishery to protect the spawn. We'd like to have this regulation coincide with that. The other thing is that we'd like to have is that, again, no hull seining can be more than 1,000 yards, or I think in Maryland, the guys are using a 960-foot hull seining. That is their hull seining by choice, according to talking to DNR. The other thing we'd also like to make it against the law to do the herding. One, not only is that disruptive to the environment, it's disruptive to the fish. I consider that a two-boat operation, which this, to go away with, is supposed to only be a one-boat operation. And again, they've been known to harass other people on the water. So I'd like to make sure that cannot be done. I think that's about, and the other thing about it is no hull seining where there is evidence of SAVs. This is very, very important to our environment, to that fishery, and to the largemouth bass fishery. And as you can see from these photos, they're destroying it. I had to go ahead and leave certain areas after they've been through there because I couldn't have a client throw a crankbait, a spinnerbait, a buzzbait, anything through the water without being clogged up by torn up SAVs. So again, I know they're destroying and they're hurting this in violation of the rules. The other thing we like to see is that if they're going to go in and do hull seining in the Virginia tributaries, that they contact VMRC at least 24 hours in advance so they know where they're hull seining. One of the problems we have up there, I've contacted law enforcement several times. I think they got one officer that covers an ungodly amount of territory. He may not be able to get up there for 2 or 3 days. But if he knows it's going on, if he can come up there and check them then, again, I've got the feeling, unless they're caught in the process of violating one or many of these rules or regulations, it's hard for them to go ahead and to enforce it.
Sounds good.
So I'd like to go ahead and have where they contact at 24 hours, where it at least gives that officer a chance to come up and check and observe that they are doing it properly. Again, I know hull seining is an important part of their harvest up there, but when we were at the Black Bass Advisory Subcommittee last month and their chairman of the waterway, or their waterman, gave a report, last year there was close to 1.5 million pounds of blue cats harvest out of the main stem of the Potomac River. Hull seining was 62,000 pounds, 2.5% of it. So I can't believe that's a major, major part of how they catch the blue cats up there. 2.5%, and they're destroying the bass fishery.
All right. So. Sounds good. Any questions from the committee?
Two.
Go ahead, please.
How many boats are involved in this?
Doing it?
Doing it.
The ones I've seen has basically been, I've witnessed all the same pair.
So two.
I hear from up there, there's only maybe two people that are operating in this region, up in that area, doing hull seining in shallow waters.
Second question. Are they Maryland registered or Virginia?
They're Maryland.
Okay.
But they're coming over to Virginia waters, fishing Virginia waters, and I consider harming Virginia waters.
All right.
Thank you.
Tom?
A couple clarifications for you, just looking at the law here. They have to contact VMRC if they're using more than one vessel to actually work the net, and that means a lot of times they'll use two to close it and such. So just if one vessel touches the net and the other doesn't, then they don't have to call in, at least from what I can see from this regulation. And They are not allowed to set the pocket within 15 feet of submerged aquatic vegetation, which, Rob, I have seen that on Pocosin Flats myself within the last couple of years. So people are doing that and breaking the law with that, I think. And they're, I think they're allowed a 1,500-foot net in Virginia, independent of what they're
Maryland,
using.
Virginia has a larger net. According to the charter captain, though, that these guys are going to buy one net they can use in both waters because one of the costs of the nets, and I was informed that they had to have those nets certified when they get them. So they said they wouldn't buy one net for Maryland, which has a shorter length requirement, and then buy one so they can come over and do Maryland, in Virginia.
And in fact, they are allowed to, if they're using two vessels, drag the net through the water for a mile, which I still think should be changed back to the way it historically was for like 50 years, which is one end and one end only will be fixed at all times.
Okay, Tom, any other questions?
Can you scroll back so we can see the map of where this is in relation to the Potomac River? I got just a glimpse of it. Being from down at this end, I'm not that familiar with that area. There you go. How far up the river is this?
This is probably halfway, a little more than halfway between the 301 Bridge and the Wilson Bridge. This is coming out of the Occoquan River, which is at the border of the dividing line of Fairfax County and Prince William County.
So where do these guys come from?
These guys, one of them that I know that I've identified just because of being up there for all the years, is coming out of Mattawoman Creek across on the Maryland shoreline. I think the next group of commercial watermen we have up there are located further south, and that's either the Dents or the Decaturs. And I've not witnessed them.
And they're also from Maryland?
No, they're Virginia. They're Virginia. They're down in the Widewater area of Virginia, down in Stafford County. Again, this is, I know it's a small part, but it's kind of specialized in this area. But I don't know what other tidal rivers in Virginia that this practice it could be doing, it could be working, that could have the same effect. But we've always been proud of the Potomac River. The Potomac River, the tidal Potomac River, for saltwater guys to be able to know, is usually ranked as one of the premier largemouth bass fisheries in the East Coast. You see the results. We have national tournaments that come in that are attracted to it. We have people. Last year, I had people from around the country and Germany that booked trips because they read about the Potomac River and its bass fishery. That's why it's important to us to protect it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Question for Rob. Yes. Don't we all have to apply with a location, and this has to be checked out for lack of SAVs, correct?
Yeah, you cannot be in an SAV area, and what Tom was indicating, you can't set your pocket in less than 3 feet of water. Then you have to have approval by the commissioner to have that site. Of course, we're talking shallower areas. When you get in the Pocosin or get out in Browns Bay, places like that, it's a lot different. It's not shallow, and the SAV is not a problem. So, but we have SAV records from the Virginia Institute of Marine Science that could be looked at. A couple of these items are already taken care of. You actually can have 1,000 yards. So that'd be much less. They'd have to have Virginia licenses of some type to be hauling in Virginia waters, and maybe licensed in Maryland as well. And then the last thing might be that we know who the individuals are. They should be contacted. They should be part of a solution if that's the direction or the recommendation of FMAC. And so, that hasn't been done yet, but certainly, they should be alerted to that. It might be the right thing to do before any other discussions take place. So I think some of the situations are pretty rugged as far as the largemouth bass goes. We certainly understand that, but we want to make sure that there's at least some ability to, say, restrict someone from being in less than 5 feet if SAV is not a problem. So we need to look at that area for SAV. That's probably the most telling thing so far, I think.
It's pretty prevalent. Actually, with the weather that we're having right now and already talking and getting reports, we already have emerging SAVs up there right now. The thing about it is our most sought after, and the milfoil will come in first. that the milfoil is also the most fragile. Milfoil versus a lot of it, whatever, will grow from a smaller stem and then branch out with it. So it doesn't have full surface to bottom contact. So when you bring that net across, it doesn't have to wipe out a huge area to wipe out the same surface on the top. It just has to take basically like that stalk out, and then it's gone. By the time that can recover, the hydrilla in that area takes over. We have areas where the milfoil does come up and it's not disturbed. Because if it blooms and comes over, it will cut down on the sunlight, which will slow down, if not stop, the hydrilla from coming up in that area. And we'll have milfoil there pretty much, unless we have a drought toward the end of the year or something like that. But we'll have it through August, September. But if we don't, the hydrilla comes in there and basically just chokes it out.
So I think staff has a little bit more to do, but Captain Martin has been patient for almost a year. When he first came to the commission, I think everyone was surprised at that time.
Well, I was told to do.
You came at public comment, I guess, and the commission really didn't take any action or give any firm direction. The herding part of it, that's something that would have to be looked at pretty closely, because there's really nothing that I know of that says you can't run your boat at the same time and just happen to be herding fish into the net. I mean, that'd be pretty creative to think about that. But, I think you did a good job portraying the situation for everyone.
The purpose of that is, again, the herding. I understand why they do it, and if it's out in the over area. But, again, it's some of that SAVs that you saw floating was done by the boat that was herding. The other thing is that myself and numerous other anglers I know on the water have been encroached, not approached, but encroached by the boat doing that.
Okay.
And that's another thing. We don't want to get a conflict out on the water.
Okay.
Sounds to me like you've got a law enforcement problem. What I'm hearing, everything they're doing is illegal to start with, except for the herding.
That's what I was, when I first started into this 2 years ago, I started guiding heavy and doing towboat heavily 3 years ago. And so I was out on the water a lot Monday through Friday. And that's when I first started witnessing this. We have records going back, and we've all talked about in the past where we've gone into these certain bays in the spring. And beginning of it had awesome times. You saw the milfoil. Came back 2 weeks later. Everything was gone. The fish were gone. We couldn't understand why. After being out there, again, a lot during that time of year, that's when we started witnessing it. Again, I understand we have one officer that I hear that's in charge of that area. And I forget, where is he from? You know where he comes from?
Eastville.
And I've witnessed it. I've tried calling, and they do have an answering machine down there sometime, but it's not an office that is operated 5 days a week.
It wouldn't do us any good to put into more regulations if the man can't enforce them to start with.
That's right.
It's not clear. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Or is that it? Okay, Tom.
It's not clear to me that he is, in fact, breaking the law. And looking at it more carefully, that if he's setting the pocket in water less than 3 feet deep, there can't be any SAV. But if it's more than 3 feet deep, there's no rules about where you can set the pocket, except it's just got to be more than 3 feet deep.
Well, if I can cut in, it sounds like he's also fishing in Virginia and may not have a Virginia license. So
I would be confident that if he's been ever, that anybody who's fishing in Virginia has a Virginia license, if he's doing it that much, that he's been at least stopped once.
Well, I'm sorry, Rob.
So we'll talk to I'll talk to Colonel Martin and Lieutenant Colonel Rhodes and see how they're doing. I think Captain Martin is absolutely right. The northern area is pretty small in terms of the law enforcement staff, and maybe it just needs a little bit more vigilance there, if possible. I mean, they are spread. I mean, some of the stories when I went up there a couple of years ago, they at times are called down to even the James River. So you can imagine what their life is like. So I'll be happy to do that. Be happy to look into a couple of these other things. But from what I know, they already do the notification. They have to notify operations 24 hours before.
If they're doing two vessels.
Yes. The SAV is a situation that we need to look at more carefully.
Well,
and contact the individuals, because
Our data show they did haul same in 2014 and 15, but not in 2016. So we need to ask them if they forgot to report.
I'm envious of your compassion for notifying them first. To me, it sounds like we should catch them first. So No, I'm serious. They know what the rules are, and I don't have anything against commercial fishermen, but this is, unless.
I'm sure they are in violation.
Okay. Yeah, we have to confirm what's going on. I agree, and we need to put some officers up there and
probably one officer.
Well, I think he needs some help, apparently, and we need to get some people on the water at a reasonable amount of time. Just a moment. Tom was next.
I would like to say one thing as far as the SAV issue for that part of the bay. When we did this, I want to say 2004, maybe, and dealt with hull seines and such, the SAV issue was prop scarring. It was not damage to the SAV itself, and it was because it was almost exclusively focused in beds of eelgrass, which are more tolerant to hull seining than the milfoil. I think one of the things we should be doing is seeking advice from VIMS as to the effect of hull seining on milfoil, just the net going across it, because apparently the observations are that it does do substantial damage. I think that's a critical parameter.
There might be
parameter.
Some information there anyway. Dr. Orth, by the way, who does the for the hull seining, for the scarring of the grass beds, he'll be here tomorrow to make the presentation, so I'll have a chance to ask him encompassing his photographs are.
Well, even if they're encompassing, if he doesn't get there the day before and the day after kind of thing for these milfoil beds, they may be getting destroyed, and he has no evidence one way or the other.
Yeah, we'll find out.
Yes, sir.
Good. We're opening up.
Well, he kind of took in my question, because I was on here, when we had these discussions a decade ago.
Because, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't understand how you can issue a license if they have to apply like everybody and there's evidence of SAVs there. They should be denied a license.
If all things are not for an area, they're just a license.
Well, let me tell you something. When you go apply for one, they ask you where you're going to fish, and then they go out and check and see if there's evidence of SAVs.
But okay. They haul the Pocosin Flats all the time, and there's grass all over.
Well, that's
always
what that's
one other place you need to look at.
That's what I want to know. What's the determining factor there?
Well, okay. The factor right now is where you set your pocket, and if there's SAV there, you've got a problem.
No, only if it's more than less than 3 feet deep.
All right. Okay.
If it's more than
Thank
three
you.
Feet deep, there can be SAV there.
You know, you pull crab scrapes all over the stuff.
Yeah. Sure.
All right.
We're used to pull a lot of crab scrapes.
Yeah.
Thank you, Captain. We really appreciate you bringing
Can
this up.
You, what's the next step?
The next step, we'll let Rob.
The next step will be fishery staff talking to law enforcement staff and also making sure that we've got all the facts right. And then we will talk to the harvesters to let them know something. It's not impossible that something can be reached here that doesn't have to have a hammer behind it. So we need to check that out first.
Like I said, I'm not trying to stop them from making a living.
I appreciate that.
But it's making it real tough for me to make a living, too.
Well, it's also tearing up the grass of the beds. And, Rob, do we need, in the future, when we bring this up again, I'd like to consider something about herding, if that's a method that they've brought up now that we need to see what our options are there, please. Yes, sir.
So, independent of reaching a mutual agreement with this particular individual or group of individuals, I'm concerned that we have a gear type, whether it's recreational or commercial, that has a clear damaging effect on SAV just by its use. And if that is the case, then I think we should be protecting, even if it's particular areas that we say for this time of year when the milfoil is growing, whatever time that's deemed to be, that those areas are restricted and can't be used by gear that will destroy the SAV. If it patently destroys it, not just because you happen to run your prop against the bottom.
What we were told by Maryland's person they brought to the Black Bass Advisory Subcommittee, Captain, I'll probably guess Billy Price, stated that most of the hull sands they would use in shallower water does not have a weight but has a cord on it because they don't want to get tangled up in debris on the bottom. But he also said the average hull sand was 12 feet deep. And I can't believe these guys have gone ahead and gotten one that's less than 12 feet just to hull sand the shallow. So if you bundle that up, that's where I think the damage is being come. Even though it may go over lay downs and debris on the bottom, it's not getting through the vegetation.
Okay, great. We really appreciate it. I'm sorry.
Are they catching catfish? Is that what they're targeting?
I think that's one of their main. I think it's catfish, yellow perch, and carp. They also can harvest snakeheads in that area, which, again, three out of four, I'm all in favor for it. Let them go ahead and get the cats and the carp and the snakeheads out of there. But, again, the just unrelenting damage it's doing to the bedding bass has an effect on us not only in the short term, but year after year after year.
I was just curious as to why they were doing it at that particular place.
That's the only thing I can...
They just have to catfish and catch them anyway.
Right. And again, through their own reports in Maryland, 2.5% of their catfish catches come from hull sanding. They said their number one was trout lines.
All right. John?
Is it reasonable that we can expect an update from staff the next time this committee meets?
Timeline, Rob? Okay.
South Atlantic Council is going to meet. That's going to be some of my time. So I hate to say yes and then have you disappointed. So,
by March? April.
If you want something thorough, probably April.
All right.
Law enforcement has to have some disposition as to what they think and what they think they can do. The harvesters also have to have some indication that they recognize that this is headed towards a serious possibly.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I got one other thing I want to bring up about this. Rob,
yes.
I'm from Virginia Beach, and we have an area down there that's called Back Bay.
Right.
They've been hull sanding down there long before I was born, and the whole place is covered with milfoil. And they hull sand for raccoon perch and red fins and...
Only thing we have to do is...
And that place isn't very deep either.
Blue crab is the only thing that we have authority over, so that's all under the Game Department.
Right.
They certainly, and they're doing the gear licenses as well. So, that happened about 3 years ago when
yep.
it was finally decided. BMRC would do...
I think Barry Knight did that, didn't he?
Yes, yes.
That needs to be looked into.
Well, for years they pumped a lot of water.
Right, until they did away with the pump.
So, yeah, I agree.
I think as far as that environment, John Odenkirk, the Game and Inland Fisheries, is very, very aware of this environment up there and would probably be a very good source to talk to.
Yeah,
they're looking at.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank the committee. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. Thanks for bringing that to us. Okay, that brings up striped bass, gentlemen.
All right, I'll tell you about striped bass. A most unusual situation at the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission earlier this month in that Maryland wanted to ask for some flexibility is the way it was, poised by the Maryland representative. They wanted to have some type of an ability to relax the regulations, and about 10% is what was used. So to relax about 10%, Virginia supported that, and frankly, no one in the Bay jurisdictions thought that something like that would pass the ASMFC. The situation is that when we went in to Addendum 4, which you are very familiar with since we had four meetings on Addendum 4, which established the 20.5% reduction for the Bay,
and 25% for the coast for striped bass. Once they redid this stock assessment, they found out that overall the fishing mortality rate had reached its target. Matter of fact, the directive was to reach the fishing mortality rate target or be below, and it was slightly below. Not a lot, but slightly below. ASMFC staff presented information that if you were to consider preliminary data from 2016 and use some relationships that had already existed for projections, that they projected there wouldn't be much room for movement at all, not even the 10%. And those in the Bay said, well, you're really just using static projections, and, you know, that's fine, except it's not something that you can really say for sure that that's the way things will turn out, because the harvest is unknown for 2016. It's not even, you know, for us, you probably realize recreationally, the season ends in December. It's going to be February until we have preliminary information. It's going to be April before we have final information. So with all that said, it passed by a very close vote. I heard 8-7. I had 8-6 with two, you know, null votes, which means the state split the difference. But it is going forward in an addendum and supposedly fast-tracked. By fast-track, what that means, by August, there should be something for the Striped Bass Management Board to vote on. And what this means really is that instead of a 20-inch minimum size limit for the recreational fishery, it could be 19. That's an example. It's not going to be much more than that. For the commercial fishery, it would mean a 10% increase in quota. So, but again, no one knows whether the management board was placating the Bay, quite frankly, and saying, well, let's give them a chance to take this out there. And no one really knows how this will end up in August. But, you know, it's important, depending on where you fish, it may be very important. But that's what stands with striped bass right now. And, of course, we'll know more. We'll probably get a hint of a little bit of more development in May at the ASMFC. But that's what we know now.
Okay. Wasn't one of the justifications for this the fact that you're fishing mostly on males in the Bay in the summer?
That's always been part of it, yeah. The resident fish, there's roughly 65% or even a little more in Maryland males. So, yeah, that was definitely part of it.
Tom?
How did we do last year for harvest compared to the Bay-wide quota?
Recreationally?
Yeah.
I don't think we have the final in yet. So, again, it'll be, well, we do have a preliminary. So if someone on my staff looked at that, it came in the 16th of February. Did anyone look at striped bass? No cigars handed out tonight? Okay. All right. Well, a lot going on, but, you know, we've been kind of dismal since 2007.
Yeah, I know. So, I mean,
on the recreational end, but I guarantee you someone's going to look on their phone for you, and they'll tell you in a minute. All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
All right. Anything else from the committee? What's here anyway? All right. Summer flounder, please.
So summer flounder has been kind of an issue the last few months. The most recent peer-reviewed benchmark stock assessment was completed in July of 2016. And that was based on data from 2015. The summer flounder stock coastwide was not overfished, but overfishing was occurring. And just for some visuals, if we look at this chart, you can see the fishing mortality rate, which is the black line with the squares, is above the reference point, which is shown by the red line. And looking at spawning stock biomass, which is shown by the solid black line here, you can see, first of all, that it's been declining over the last several years, but it is above the threshold, which is the red line. The target is shown by the dashed line up above, so the spawning stock biomass estimate is below that target. And if you look at those bars at the bottom, those represent recruitment, and you can see that there's a dip in recruitment in 2010, and it's stayed below average since then. some background on management. Summer flounder is managed by the ASMFC and MAFMC, and in practice, it's been managed on a target quota basis. Until 2001, we had one set of coastwide measures, but those state allocations, which are the target quotas, were set in 2001, and each state was given a target equivalent or based on its percent of the total harvest in 1998. But there were concerns about the limitations of using data for just 1 year and over the equitable access issue, so not everyone in all the states could access that fishery equally. So in 2014, we moved to a regional management structure, and under that structure, states are grouped into regions, and those regions are assigned target quotas. And a regional target quota is simply the sum of the targets of each of the states in that region. We're in the Delmarva region with Delaware and Maryland. And if we look at the 2016 target, we were about 244,000 pounds. And in 2016, we're projected to be well below our target. And if we went back to the 1998-based allocations, the Delmarva region's target for 2017 would be over 282,000 pounds. But when the coastwide harvest limit for 2017 was set at 3.77 million pounds, that showed that we need a serious reduction coastwide. It's 30% less than the 2016 RHL, but it's a 41% reduction from the coastwide harvest in 2016. So five management options were developed to try and get to this 41% reduction, and they ranged from having states that were under their targets in 2016 not liberalize and not reduce, to every state taking a 30% reduction, with northern states taking more of a reduction. So under each of those options, we had vast differences in the targets for each region. And the most severe option for Virginia would have been increase to a 17-inch size limit and a reduction in the possession limit to three fish. We had public hearings on all of those options. The option overwhelmingly preferred by Virginia recreational fishermen was not making any changes to our regulations. Makes sense, right? But the ASMFC voted on option five, and under this option, most regions increase their minimum size to 1 inch, and all regions must have a possession limit of four or fewer fish. This requires us to move our size limit from 16 inches up to 17, but we get to keep our four fish possession limit, and we get to keep our open season year round. And tomorrow we'll be presenting this to the commission, but that's basically the state of summer flounder.
Go back one.
Thank you.
This is the regulation that we have currently with the proposed changes that will go to the commission.
Any comments from the committee or questions from the committee?
So, Katie, may tell them the peril of option
right.
five.
So under this option, where all the states increase size limit and have a bag limit of four or fewer, we're still not projected to reach the 41% reduction. And that's the coastwide reduction necessary. If it is decided that that's unacceptable, we could all face much more severe reductions. However, there's an option that if we hear that that's not likely to be approved, there could be an emergency meeting of the board and a revote to adopt one of the other four options. So that could result in us keeping the 17-inch size limit, or it could result in us having that size limit and going down in the possession limit.
And when will that be? We don't know.
It's GARFO, so Greater Atlantic Regional Fisheries Office, NIMS, they make the decision. So this is a joint plan, as you saw Katie May do, but the Mid-Atlantic Council has the lead. They set all the specifications, as you know, and National Marine Fisheries Service has to bless it. Option five is somewhere between 22% and 30% reduction. Seem to be an understanding that GARFO was looking at other justifications besides, you know,
counting every little reduction point, but they were also looking at some qualitative information as to why this would work out. Frankly, you know, maybe it's as good as the other options. We're in a region. Our constituents wanted option one. Delaware and Virginia wanted option one. Maryland did not. So we had quite a discussion about what to do there, and eventually, you know, from our camp, from the Delmarva camp, option five came out. So we'll have to see. And Katie May is going to tell you why it's even worse for black sea bass recreation.
Okay. Another disaster. I guess
any questions on flounder from the committee?
Just one for Rob. I understand up the coast, they're really raising a stink about this, New Jersey and up in that area.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Yeah, there was a speech from the commissioner of New Jersey who gave about a, I'd say, 10 or 12 minute speech. I happen to be standing fairly close to him because I hadn't gotten back to my seat yet. And he was definitely pretty adamant. He's talked about the terrible data several times, management problems several times, and then that was followed by the governor's aide, who gave a speech on behalf of the governor. New Jersey was not pleased that day at all. Matter of fact, they wanted to have a situation where they kept things the way they were, and then looked at everything and later on came back with some other type of option. And of course that didn't, you know, that garnered two votes at the ASMSC, one from New Jersey and one from Delaware. So it was a little heated.
Didn't they also promise a lawsuit? Was that New Jersey or New York at the ASMSC?
I didn't hear that, but, you know,
I heard it from one of them. Yes.
I stay in touch with Eric Burnley, I know.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And he lives in Delaware now, in Lewis. And all I've seen all last season was all these pictures of fantastic flounder catches. Flounder here, from what I hear, seem to be abundant offshore.
Offshore.
We just don't have an inshore fishery anymore. Is there anything to that? Has this got something to do with warming ocean currents, changes like that, that are affecting, you know, we have the same situation with striped bass. You know, right now there's all the striped bass you want 5 miles outside the light tower.
You know, I'm not the best person for that, but I do know that, for example, someone like Dr. Jonathan Hare, who made a presentation to the commission a few months ago, he is definitely working on climate change, or was very much until he became director of the North Industry Science Center in Woods Hole. And there are several others. There's a fellow, Malin Pinsky, Dr. Pinsky from Rutgers, and there's a whole host where NOAA has definitely funded a lot of studies that way. And some of the information, maybe you'd like to see it at a meeting, is, you know, they are projections, but they're really not very friendly to the Mid-Atlantic area. Now, we're in a very vulnerable area. Temperature swings are much more pronounced than other parts of the coast area. And, you know, there's more to it than temperature, but, you know, it's the forecasts aren't that great. You know, one of the forecasts that I heard, this is all that I heard now at the Mid-Atlantic Council, is that, you know, within a matter of years, say 20, Atlantic croaker will really have a center of distribution in Delaware. Now, that's a South Atlantic species. You know, that's always been North Carolina and Virginia. But if you've been watching Atlantic croaker, the heyday from 1996 to about 2005 has ended. You know, maybe it comes back with a couple good year classes, maybe not. Spot, another fish that most of you know has had some problems. So, you know, I think we need to wait for more information. We'll try and collect what information we can so you can have it as well. We have your emails. If you're receptive, we'll send you that information. And, you know, when Dr. Hare was here, it was unbelievable because, you know, he's just very knowledgeable. And any kind of questions, he's very good at. And he, frankly, when he doesn't know, he says, I don't know. But, I mean, you know, and you've heard Dr. Hare as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Anything else from the committee? All right, Katie May.
Black sea bass is presenting some potentially bigger problems that are going to be interesting to try to figure out. They're also managed by ASMFC and MAFMC, and there were two-year specifications setting the catch and landings limits for 2016 and 2017. Those were set in 2015 with the understanding that they would be revised once we had a new benchmark stock assessment completed, and that new assessment passed review in December of 2016. And it was used to establish new 2017 through 19 specifications. So, sorry, that's kind of small image. But basically, preliminary revised recommendations recreationally were for a recreational harvest limit in 2017 of 4.29 million pounds. And this is the highest RHL we've seen since the RHL started for this fishery in 1998. It's a 52% increase from the 2016 RHL. And based on numbers that were best estimates until 10 days ago, we would have required an 8% reduction from 2016 projected landings to stay within this harvest limit. So for 2017, we need to reduce by 8%. And staff recommended that this reduction be taken only by the northern states, partially because southern states make up less than 4% of the reduction that we would be able to meet. The Scientific and Statistical Committee agreed with those revised numbers from staff, and the Monitoring Committee also agreed with those numbers and with the recommendation that reductions be taken only by northern states. That was given a necessary reduction of 8% or less. And new numbers came out on the 17th. Showing projected harvest at 2016 at 5.71 million pounds. And this will require not an 8% reduction, but a 24.9% reduction from the projected 2016 harvest in order to stay within the harvest limit. You can see the previous projections up here with now the new or current projections and the differences between those projections. The red numbers are states where the projections previously were much lower than what we see based on the numbers we currently have. So you can see Virginia stayed almost right on. There are some other states that landed a lot more than we expected them to. And what this boils down to is we need a much larger reduction coastwide. So we don't really know what's going to happen with this. It's likely that southern states will have to take some of the burden of the reduction just because it is such a high reduction. And this is not something that we had a plan set up for. So we'll just have to stay tuned and wait and see what's going to happen with this.
When do we expect to hear?
April-ish, maybe?
I think that talked to Bob Beal from the ASMFC today, and it sounds as if they started to figure out with National Marine Fisheries Service how they can move forward, because at the Mid-Atlantic Council, everyone except the regional director voted to waive the 8%, to not even worry about it, to just go forward status quo to 2016. Now that it's 24, almost 25%, it's caused a lot of problems. So we don't know. What we're going to do is ask the commission to wait until April, and then the soonest the season would have started would have been May 15th. So if we wait until April, we could adopt something then. It doesn't give everyone a whole lot of notice, a couple of weeks, but I think that's where we are.
Catch you in a minute. Is the North Carolina numbers, how consistent? I mean, that's ridiculous. What is their normal landings for black sea bass? Do you know?
I can go back and check on that for you, but I don't know from the top of my head.
North Carolina has that mixture of flounder species, so really, when you can't go on the website and figure out what North Carolina summer flounder landings are. They have to do it because it's really from Oregon Inlet Bridge out. That's where you start counting summer flounder. Otherwise, you have
southern flounder and southern right. flounder, and you have a real mix. So, but they've been typically low, but they've also been fishing on about a 15 and a half inch size limit for a while.
Now, this is sea bass, right?
Yeah. Did I say flounder?
Yes.
You can't go on their website because they have to do
the
split.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Joe.
Okay. All right.
Now I'm confused. Is this flounder or is that sea bass?
Sea bass.
That's sea bass. Sea bass. Okay. Question. Just an observation. The big problem is New York and New Jersey. I mean, I would assume that you're going to argue status quo for us and penalize the states that have the issue.
So this isn't them going over a target. This is the projections being much lower than what was expected. So this is just based on previous MRF estimates compared to the updated MRF numbers that were just updated.
Bringing up a good point. What's going on, I'll now get into the Black Sea Bass. What's going on is that the northern region has had a conference call. So they talk to each other, and they're more or less holding the fort. They don't want to give in. They still want status quo. If that happens, then the regional director has no choice but to impose measures on the federal waters. And, of course, that affects every state from Delaware to North Carolina. And we could really take the kibosh on that one. So we have to watch this one pretty closely. And, you know, we hope that, you know, common decency prevails, because it's the northern state that's, you know, really been taking a lot of the Black Sea Bass. So.
And the regional director is from New Hampshire, is he not?
Massachusetts originally, yeah. Massachusetts originally.
Anybody else?
So that's a good point you made.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
Rob, in North Carolina, what is the harvest method? Trawl net?
This is recreational.
Oh, this is all recreational. Yeah. This is all recreational.
Yeah. There shouldn't be any figuring it out. There's no inshore, out of shore. This is harvest, period.
What in and what out is
Black sea bass. I mean, it's no matter where you catch it.
Yeah.
But it may be that that's where the fishery is, but anything they catch in North Carolina should count.
So, you know, the stock is split. They have two
different. Oh, they have two different stocks. Okay.
Everything south is part of the south.
I think everything's going to become so amalgamated by the time we get another decade that, state-specific management and allocation is going to be changed. So that's the only thing good I say about the fact that we got pushed into regions. Everything else I didn't care for too much, as many others didn't either. But, you know, it does make sense. I think Lewis looked up one time back in 2004 that we had 48% out-of-state anglers who were part of our fishery in Virginia. And the reason was we had a smaller size limit. Now that's flounder. That's not black sea bass, that's flounder. But I mean, it's pertinent to a lot of our fisheries now.
All right. Okay, Katie May, are you doing toe tog for us too?
That's Chuck.
She can.
But most of the tog stuff that's happening so far is has been happening at the, I guess this is on, happening at the board level. So I'll take TOG. And not, news isn't so bad here. I don't think I brought this up yet, though. Oh, wait, sorry. Maybe I did. Yeah, I did. Okay, so one of the issues that we may have to be dealing with is commercial tagging of all tog that are harvested. The New England states through New Jersey, for quite some time have been concerned with illegal harvest by both recreational boats that are selling their catch and, I guess, to some extent, some commercial fish that are going unreported. But really, the biggest problem has been some big stings amongst headboats that are selling their catch.
Really?
So the idea behind this is something like striped bass a tag in every fish in the commercial fishery. The problem with it is there's a very, very good lucrative live market for tog, so the tags that they had to find need to be in fish that are being kept alive and sold at restaurants. So there's a study done out of the New York Sea Grant out of Long Island. So what you're seeing here is kind of a modified jaw tag that you see in some freshwater species with the applicator. The idea behind this is that they're tagging the tog in the opercle, the hard part of their cheek, and you can see the tag on there. The trials have been pretty successful. These fish seem to be in pretty good shape at the end of, I think they held them for a month. And tog hold well. They're not too concerned about eating, but they can be fed, so they don't lose them for conditioning. So they had a, here's some of the highlights. They held fish for, like I said, for a month with 15 tags, 6 controlled. And just, you know, the long and short of it was none of the fish were hurt. They seem to be in pretty much the same condition whether tagged or untagged. You know, the logistics of it for most states, it's not really the most appealing idea, especially if you're in a state that doesn't seem to have this issue, which we don't believe we do in any way, shape, or form. Of course, when we went to tagging for striped bass, it was in a process where we were looking at an ITQ system. So it was limited entry. We knew who was participating in the fishery. We knew who to get tags to. Right now, there isn't any such thing for tog. Any commercial harvester can harvest them. So if tags are forced on the states, it is going to be the kind of thing that we're going to have to consider how we would do that. And, you know, would limited entry be the only way forward? I will note that some of the folks that do fish for tautog, because it's not something you just usually catch by accident. It's a very targeted fishery, and some of the folks that have participated in that fishery have made requests in the past to go limited entry. But, you know, that's always a long, slow process. So, and ASMFC hasn't had any discussions on how states would be handling, administering, and funding these things. I'm sorry, Jeff.
No, please.
Okay. Go ahead. Yeah. There hasn't been a decision made yet, but they spent a lot of time figuring out what other solutions there could be. And they did want to go forward at least with that tagging trial, which was successful. So it's one more drop in the bucket on whether or not that might be coming. The last tautog assessment that was done also created regions. So you're familiar with summer flounder. The regions are specifically just management regions. So when we talk about Delmarva, we're talking about one coast-wide flounder stock where we have our own target. With tautog, the theory has always been, and the science showing to this point, is that there really isn't much migration. So we always felt that the smaller the stock assessment, the more regional the stock assessment, the more appropriate it would be. And so this was the first time we were ever actually able to run a model for smaller regions. So there's a Mass Rhode Island region, a Long Island Sound, a New York, New Jersey, and a Delmarva region. So management will be going along, obviously, with these smaller stock assessments. Delmarva came out kind of in the best situation as far as what the other states are dealing with. Every other state is dealing with overfishing, and the stock is overfished. We are in an overfished status meaning that the spawning stock biomass, the females that are out there, are below what we think might be a good target. They're even below what we would consider a safe threshold right now. For those of you that have been up here a while, you know we've gone through a lot of cuts in this fishery since 2008 especially. And so in our three-year fishing mortality average is right at target right now. So it does seem like there's been a response in this region to the regulations we've been putting in place. So we'll see how this, if this continues. 2016 also looks to be a good year as far as fairly low fishing estimate or harvest estimates. So that's good news. There isn't a rebuilding plan for this species. The northern states, as I said, are in such bad shape, they're afraid to try and put a target on when these stocks have to be rebuilt. So they are, they've got to make some tough decisions to get their fishing mortality down. Right now, we don't necessarily have to do anything. There were some projections. This is not as relevant for us. The other states are trying to reduce their fishing mortality, and they were looking at harvest levels to see if they could, when they can get back on track. Of course, for us, we're not in that situation. So really, staying status quo, the assumption would be we would stay at our fishing target. Now, it's not necessarily assuming that we're going to be rebuilding our spawning stock biomass. There's only an 18% chance that we would be able to rebuild the spawning stock biomass by 2020. But as I said, there's no specific target that we're being forced to do that. One other thing that was brought up by the Maryland board member, they had asked the technical committee if they would work out some options for us for the recreational fishery. Currently, we are at different minimum sizes, or at least Delaware has a 15-inch minimum size for part of the year, and we have different opening and closing dates. So they wanted to consider one single recreational option for the three regions. And it's not something that we would be forced into necessarily, but like I said, the Maryland board member asked for this with the assumption that if we had a regional target and Delaware kind of got in line, at least with the 16-inch minimum size limit, that it might allow us to have some leeway with the seasons. We'll see how that shakes out. And I went through that quickly, so I do hope any questions you have might help me with anything I missed there.
Okay. You had a question, Pete?
Why are you considering limited entry?
If every harvester was allowed to harvest tautog but had to have a tag in them, we wouldn't know who to give tags to.
I understand that, but why couldn't you just do something like require a permit, and then with the permit you'd get tags?
If folks thought that they would participate in the fishery, they'd get the permit and would give them some number of tags. Yeah. It's a possibility, I guess.
What's the maximum number of harvesters?
No, I know that. I don't know if we've gone above 30 harvesters, but it's small. It's a small fishery.
Any other questions? And the tags would be just for commercial. Okay. Anything else? All right, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
826,000 pounds of striped bass. Few people hit their phones, so that's not as bad as it's been, obviously.
But it's nowhere near what we were allowed.
Well, we were held to a reduction. The Baywatch quota went by the boards in 2014 when we got into the Sudan Force. There's no more Baywatch quota. So that's a real shame. doesn't let us have the flexibility of management. So, but Ryan's going to talk about phobia. Appreciate everyone, your patience. Obviously, you can tell that a lot goes on in 4 months. So I think that's about the last time that we're able to meet with this committee. And so thank you for your patience.
Evening. There has been a lot of stuff that has begun since a year ago. So the plan for this presentation is to touch on everything just a little bit and trust that between the public comment and the discussion following that, we'll probably flesh out most of it, anything that was left a little too glossed over. So just a refresher on management. Cobia is managed by the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council. We're part of the Atlantic Migratory Group, which are the states of Georgia up through New York. And currently, we're managed on an annual catch limit, ACL, 620,000 pounds for the recreational and 50,000 pounds for the commercial. That's a 92%, 8% split. It has gone down incrementally, 10,000 pounds for each sector over the past 3 years, just as a direction from the most recent stock assessment that said there was a declining trend in biomass. And then as a result of the management difficulties that arose last year, sort of a mismatch between the federal waters and what the states wanted, that led to the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission being invited along for the ride. And that is just getting underway now. I'm part of the plan development team, and I will be on the technical committee as Virginia's representative. Right now, we're just starting on the fishery management plan, which will be what determines regulations. And we have a working group that will be getting underway soon that will look at different allocation options. So that could be state-specific quotas. It could be state-specific seasons, which is something that I think a lot of states wanted last year, but the South Atlantic Council couldn't accommodate that with its regulations. So there are a few different options, and too early to tell how it's going to shake out, but the work is being done. So to answer the specific question of why we're here tonight, it's because of a second straight year of estimated high harvest. In 2015, it was 1.5 million. With Virginia and North Carolina having extremely high estimated harvest. This year, it's more just Virginia as the lone wolf with high estimated harvest from the Marine Recreational Information Program, which is the federal sampling program. So that number from Georgia up through New York is 1.3 million pounds. And as a result, so if you remember last year, the feds did some projections and announced that, well, we think under typical harvest of the past 3 years, we're projected to catch that 630,000 pounds by June 20th. So they announced the closure of June 20th. This year, NIMS felt that they had a little bit of past behavior to go off of. So they said, well, if what happened last year happens again this year, which is North Carolina and Virginia staying open, those two states alone will catch the ACL in their state waters. So NIMS, you know, their accountability measures dictate that they have to prevent an overage of the ACL at all costs. So the most they could do is just close it effective immediately, which is what they did at the end of January. And so that puts us in a position where NIMS is kind of already assuming we're going to have some sort of season. So that's why we're here. That's why we're talking about what we want that to look like. This is just a timeline for, you know, I think hopefully it'll be helpful for everyone looking to stay involved and stay up to date with information. Tonight is the FMAC meeting. We're here now. Tomorrow is commission meeting for COBIA Part 1. So that's when we request a public hearing. There will be no public comment taken at that time. No decisions are made. So nothing, no opportunities are necessarily lost. That's just when we bring it back to the commission's attention. Give them a little bit of a refresher on COBIA, and then we request a public hearing to be held at the March 28th commission meeting. So that's when we'll take public comment, similar to how we're doing tonight, and that's when the commission will ultimately vote to set regulations.
Will there be any other kind of meeting in between now and next month? You just going to come up with regulations and present?
Well, I imagine that members of the public will have their suggestions at this meeting, and I think that's sort of one of the points and one of the things we hope to get out of the discussion is what is the will of the public. And then even then, at the March 28th commission meeting, there will be more opportunity for public comment where there can be a little bit of that back and forth.
I think if the chair and others want a meeting before a public hearing, then we can do that as well. That's usually, again, the track record is only 1 year ago where we really got everyone involved, but certainly, you know, two meetings is worthwhile, but it's all up to the chair and the committee.
Yeah, I don't know if we can get more committee members to show up. I don't have a problem with it. I think the more the better. But let's see how far we get tonight.
So you have a commercial quota of 50,000 pounds. Is that East Coast, Florida, East Coast, North?
Georgia through New York.
Georgia through New York.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at, like, based on 2015, a 30 or 40% reduction in the commercial fishery, too.
Mm-hmm. From 15 to 16, it went from 60,000 pounds down to 50.
Well, it lists right here, if you go to the National Marine Fisheries Service, that North Carolina in 15 was 52,000, Virginia was 27, and then there's another three or four.
I see what you're saying, yeah. There did end up being an overage in 2015, so initially they didn't think there was. They didn't announce a closure, and then a few months in they received a bunch of late harvest reports, and it turned out that they were going over. If you go back further than that, before 2015, the general trend is North Carolina in the low 20s and Virginia a little bit below
that's
that.
That's because Virginia has been growing this fishery, which in theory the commission was going to watch and make sure it didn't happen for the commercial fishery when we went to a one fish limit, whenever that was. I mean, that was one of the... Yeah, which it was like a 7,000 or 8,000 pound harvest then, and now it's up to 27,000 pounds.
All right.
Yeah, so this slide right here is from the last stock assessment that was done for cobia. Getting a little stale now. Obviously, data's just up through 2011. But this was a reason, I think, for a lot of the strife, because this graph right here basically represents the ratio of biomass to the biomass at maximum sustainable yield. So if that number dips below 1, then we're in trouble. So that would be those dashed lines down there. So I referred to the incremental drops in the commercial and recreational annual catch limits, 10,000 pounds over the course of 2 or 3 years. That was the reason for that, and so that was the initial reason for concern and why the accountability measures were ultimately triggered as these harvest estimates got higher and higher. And this is something that has become part of the conversation just because that also came out of the assessment. So prior to 2014, when all the action and voting was finished following the stock assessment, prior to that time, East Florida was part of the Atlantic Migratory Group. So it basically went from the Florida Keys all the way up through New York. And before the stock assessment, the ACL was around 1.5 million. And following the stock assessment, the ACL ended up being, it ended up being 690,000 pounds for the total commercial and recreational. And so probably something that was a little confusing at first was that the drop in ACL was due to two factors. Number one is Florida being removed from the Atlantic Migratory Group. Number two was just that declining biomass trend meant that they had reason to be concerned about the fishery. And so how this happened is because, you know, these are two largely independent events. Research that was done by South Carolina Department of Natural Resources through both genetic tagging and actual physical tagging program, which is fish movement, their research suggested that most of the cobia that you'd catch off the east coast of Florida are more likely Gulf fish than Atlantic fish. And so they recommended that East Florida be actually lumped in with the Gulf stock. And so what happened was after they made that decision, then they started to run the stock assessment model. But the important point about this decision is that, you know, quota was not taken away from the Atlantic stock. It's just that these were always Gulf fish from a biological standpoint, and this was more or less setting the record straight according to the data that they had at the time. But, you know, I guess, and we can not know this for sure because the stock assessment was run without East Florida, but as a hypothetical, if you put East Florida back in, it's not a guarantee that at the end of the assessment they recommend an ACL of 1.5 million pounds because part of that reduction was just the state of the stock. But this issue is being revisited with renewed passion. I know Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina at least all have research programs that are addressing this, just because obviously this has become a very important fishery. And they're going to be getting information from both sides of this issue. As I said, there's two things that caused this decision. One was the genetic information that said, well, the Georgia through New York seems to be the most genetically distinct population, but there's also movement data, so that most of the fish that are being tagged and recaptured, that's where that split would be suggested, is a little bit down into Florida, and they just moved it up to Georgia. So Virginia Institute of Marine Science is doing genetic work, but also they have some tagging work that will allow them to track the movement of the fish, and that's going to be important too. And I know that other states are working on this, and the stock boundary will be revisited for the next stock assessment. There was a stock ID workshop scheduled for this year. It got cut, but for cobia specifically, they'll still be doing this exercise. It'll just be occurring at the same time as the stock assessment. So when the ACLs are recalculated as a result of that assessment, it'll be including whatever decision they come to based on this new information. Another point of confusion that arose last year, and you know, for better or for worse, this is what it is that sometimes when NIMS releases information, they'll cite something as FSC, which stands for the Southeast Fisheries Science Center down in Florida. So all South Atlantic species managed by the South Atlantic Council, NOAA scientists basically recalculate the average weight of a fish that comes from the MRIP survey. So if you were to run an MRIP query just on the website, the public access query, you'll get the MRIP number. But eventually NOAA, out of the Southeast Center, will release this slightly adjusted number. And so far up to this point, it hasn't been radically different, but it is going to be different. And in a sense, it is MRIP data. But in order to get what they call a more robust average weight of a cobia, for example, they're going to make sure they have at least 30 samples of a fish weight, whereas MRIP, you could have an average weight that's only obtained from 10 fish. So they believe this to be a more robust estimate, and that's why they use that data, the SEFSC data, for the ACL calculations. You might remember last year the Southeast Center numbers were slightly lower than what they were for MRIP. Obviously, that's not a guarantee, but that's just how it worked out last year. So getting back to the issue of the harvest, I kind of just wanted to get some of that background information in there. This is really why we're here. These are the estimated numbers between 2015 and 2016. So if you look at Virginia highlighted in red, these are what the estimated harvests were just for a single year for the state of Virginia. Obviously, those two numbers alone are higher than the recreational ACL. And it was the same thing for North Carolina in 2015. Their regulations that they enacted for 2016 appear to have led to a reduction in harvest, whereas ours didn't. Both, I can say, were significant steps. But for one reason or another, the reduction didn't show up in our estimates. So obviously that's something that we have to really consider when we're trying to figure out what we want the regulations to be. You know, what do we have to do to get a reduction? I guess I'll see people write, and I'll just leave it up for a few seconds.
Weren't our regulations lower to start with?
Yeah, Virginia has always had pretty strict regulations for cobia, and obviously from 15 to 16, we did all we could. And you can see by this table comparison here, size limit went up by 3 inches, possession limit stayed the same because it's already as low as it can be. The vessel limit, we didn't have one before last year, and now we have two per boat, where only one of those fish can be bigger than 50 inches to protect the larger spawning females. Established a closure of August 30th, which, you know, obviously taken out September, there are fish caught in September, but, you know, July and August are big months for effort and harvest. And then the gear restriction of prohibited gaffing recreationally. So obviously these are not trivial measures to have adopted, but they just didn't show up in terms of showing a recreational harvest that would be reduced. And so I think the probably the most important point to come out of this is that we projected that harvest out using those regulations from 2016. You know, before we voted on them, we looked at what it would do. You know, we used 3 years of wave-by-wave data from 2013 to 2015. We put in the new regulations, looked at the raw MRIP data, and we projected harvest to be about 330,000 pounds. And so that's what we were planning on when we set those regulations, and obviously the MRIP estimate was much, much higher than that. So, unfortunately, you know, when you slice MRIP data down to the month or down to the wave, it's not guaranteed to be reliable. And we saw that last year. And so I think at this point, in the interest of making sure that we represent our anglers the best way possible, you know, I think instead of trying to game the system and figure out which weeks or which days give us the most reduction, you know, I think it's just going to be important to get a season that works for charter captains, for tackle shop people, but does provide some sort of conservation benefit, so at least we can say that we went through it as much as we could.
Jeff?
So I have one more slide if you just want me to run through it and then
finish.
So, and really it's just a rehashing, you know, what can we do? I think staff's position is that increasing the length limit much more could be dangerous only because of the sex ratio according to size. We have samples taken from Old Dominion University that would suggest that the 75th percentile for male cobia is about 43 inches total length. So 75% of the male cobia are smaller than 43 inches. Only 25% of the male cobia out there are bigger than 43 inches. So if you take the size limit from 40 inches to 41, 42, 43, you're placing the majority of the harvest pressure on females, which, according to these Old Dominion samples, have a mean size of 44 inches. So they're just, if the more you fish bigger fish, the more likely it is to be a female. So staff, you know, has really, really thought long and hard about that 40-inch size limit because they said, well, we don't want to go much more than that. So vessel limit, it'd be tough to go much lower. Obviously, that'll be back on the table. Season length is probably going to be the most flexible management measure we have. You know, even closing August 30th took out, you know, maybe a month of the season, and, you know, that still leaves 2.5-3 months of good cobia fishing left. And that may be, if we want to go more restrictive than that, then it's going to have to probably cut into that summertime. And then one thing that we heard as staff, I personally heard a lot of concerns from charter boat captains who said that the gaffing ban was particularly tough on them just because it becomes a safety issue with a lot of people in the boat. And then obviously pier fishermen who, you know, how the heck are you going to net a cobia from a pier? So, you know, I think, and I'm sure we'll hear from some of the people, some of the public comment, but that would probably be back on the table just because of some of the concerns it caused people just for safety alone. So that's all I have. Like I said, it really was just glossing over each of the major topics. I'd be happy to field any questions from staff. Okay. And then I'm sure, like I said, the discussion will probably get going in a little bit.
No doubt. Tom?
So we're going to have mandatory recreational reporting on this fish next year, or this coming season.
This coming season, correct.
So what happens if we come up and say, gee, MRIP, you're wrong by 30%, 50%, whatever, and we're not catching as many as you think we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that going to matter?
Well, it's tough to say, especially because even without the mandatory reporting in last year, we made the decision to do what we did, even knowing what the emerald numbers were and not having that harvest data. Obviously, in its first year, I wouldn't expect it to quote-unquote replace MRIP, you know, especially in the Fed's eyes. But if we can get what we feel like is good compliance from this reporting program, then obviously that'll give us more of a leg to stand on if the situation comes up as you describe it.
Towards that end, when an officer stops a vessel and finds cobia on the vessel, is he going to, like the commercial fishery, I believe they do, give a report back to staff that this vessel is one that you should be getting a report, so that you know they didn't report?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it'll be in each and every case, but they do intend to provide us information to check in.
So it should be the vessel number is what it's registered to? Is that right? So that means that we will have a mechanism for enforcement, and I would hope that staff applies in equal enforcement to recreational fishermen for noncompliance that they do to commercial guys.
Yeah, and everyone.
I mean, it's the only way that we can get this to fly with MRIP,
sure,
or to fly with National Marine Fisheries Service to say, no, you're wrong.
Yeah,
it's not the dockside interview and the average weight that I worry about. Their telephone, their number of angler trips and number of anglers, to me, has just been outrageously high. I've looked at the numbers for I haven't looked at it in a few years, but if you look at the fisheries FIP program and the license numbers, I think Virginia has 250,000 recreational fishermen, and that accounts for people under 16 and 20% noncompliance and all. Yeah, I say that goes into that 250,000 number, but the point is that if you use that as a number, they're saying the average angler goes out like 10 times a year,
mm-hmm.
and I just don't believe that.
Okay, anybody else on the committee? All right, we're going to go to the audience, I'm sorry, do you have something else?
Oh, I thought someone else.
Yeah, Jeff, do you have a preferred position of what you want to see happen?
So what we're going to ask from the audience.
I know that's what we're going to ask of the audience, but I'm curious, does staff have a preferred position at this point?
Well, I would say if we have a meeting in March, which we should be, we can probably give you a better inkling. But if you listen to Ryan, what's up in the air a little bit is the season. And then, you know, we also have to hear comments about what it's like to close federal waters. We know that Georgia and South Carolina in recent years have a federal waters fishery. We also have to talk a little bit about where the ASFC is from and those kind of things. By March, frankly, based on what happened last year, there's really no bearing on this year. And last year, it was sort of is this a mandate? Is this compliance? What are we really doing? But with federal waters already being closed, some of the first comments I heard were, whoopee. Now we can go do what we want. Well, I mean, that has to be something that I really thought about carefully. You know, the ASMSC is moving ahead. They just started to look at thoughts of allocation. They weren't real specific at the last meeting in early February, but, you know, they're there, and the ASMSC plans to have something in 2018. So, I mean, I don't mind saying that what happens is that I hinted at it earlier in that when you have a joint plan, Mid-Atlantic Council for Summer Flounder Stuff and Black Sea Bass takes the lead. They set the specifications. The ASMSC has to follow suit. Well, we're facing a situation with the ASMSC where complementary is the word, but it's going to be the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council and CERO, the NIPS, that are really going to be setting those specifications. And then we have to wait all the way to 2019 to get the results of the next assessment and see if this Florida situation can be know, dealt with efficiently, everything else. I mean, so for at least 2018 and 19, it could be, once we get out of the ASMFC, that the harvest that, even if you take half of MRIP, those type of harvests won't be available. And then we're faced with a situation, pardon me, Ryan, for...
No, that's fine.
We're faced with the situation that we were faced with summer flounder from 1999 up to 2013, where if you go over, you have to make some amends. But it's going to be different than that because we're in a unit stop, right? And so anyone who goes over, these accountability measures kick in. Now, the South Atlantic Council has moved the accountability measures so that it's only 2016. And if you read it, because Ryan sent it to me today, because I was looking for it, it says the regional director can look at the trends and in the fishery, and the regional director can make the determination of what action needs to be taken for accountability measures. Well, federal waters got closed. That's the accountability measure. So this is not going to be an ideal situation, no matter how we look at it. We've gone from being open-ended for many years to now where, you know, there's neighbors to the left of us, neighbors to the right of us, there's management agencies ahead of us. You know, it's really going to be something to think about for the commission when they, you know, meet in late March, March 28th. So convoluted, yes.
Please.
And just something I had thought of for Mr. Powers' point about the reporting. NOAA recently released a statement on electronic reporting, and obviously you know the rate at which these updates occur. It's a fairly slow process, but over the past number of years, it seems as though NOAA has begun warming up to the idea of electronic reporting and even hinted at, you know, years down the road, allowing for a more explicit focus on these programs, even if they're not conducted by NOAA or MRIP. And I don't say this to get anyone's hopes up, because obviously it could be years down the road, it could come to nothing, but there is incentive to working on this program and making sure it works, because it does take a few years to start building a data set and to start building that credibility. And so the reporting program we have now could be one of the first ones that begins to contribute considerably to something like cobia management or tilefish group or other issues or other fisheries we already have it for. So it seems as though NOAA is at least paying attention to these things, and should we find a way to make them work, then I do see a more active role in the future. But, you know, obviously it doesn't help this year's situation.
There's one last, I guess, tool for managers now. The MRIP program has a new standard for ways to estimate rare events. The councils have used it for sea bass, so they'll go to a larger... You don't get the same resolution, but you get to smooth out something like if we had what seems to be an insane wave four, then they can go to collapsing cells and smooth out that estimate. So again, if we have reporting that suggests that spike shouldn't be there, it's all the more reason for us to say, you know, to MRIP, can you please rerun this estimate using the smoothing factor for rare events. And it's also, I just want to point out that we're starting this, ASMFC is going to have a working group that's going to be considering a lot of things, including allocation, and we will be requesting that those estimates are rerun for that process as well. So.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Yes, please.
Ryan, could you go back a slide or two?
Sure.
Yes, right there. Yeah, you said that, you know, the length limit, you can't really change that, or you wouldn't want to.
Yeah, obviously we can, and we can go up an inch or two, but, you know, each inch we get more nervous about it.
But basically that would not be a good thing to do. So the vessel limit, isn't going to have that much of a big bearing on it, too, if you go to one, which I think one would be a mistake because you'd have more trouble, more dead discards. So that leaves the season length. What would, because staff is here, so what would staff's recommendation be to address this problem? Or season length. That's the only option that you're saying that we have to change something, to set the season. We're here. We're not here to talk about 2018 or 19. I think everybody here wants to talk about 2017. So what would staff's recommendation be for 2017 season?
I mean, at this point, we don't have an official recommendation. I could explain how our projections work and what sort of effect things could have. But at this point, I think it would be best to start with what the fishermen want. We'll see what it can lead to.
We have to hear from people, first of all. But second of all, the reason I mentioned recreational summer flounder, because for year after year, it was like carrying a heavy weight because you had to predict. You saw what Ryan's slide did. He predicted 331,000 pounds. We ended up with 919,000 or whatever it was. We used to do that with summer flounder every year. There are people in this room who are on committees where we tried to tackle this, and you either came up short or long. You never quite got it right, so you had to go back and do it. So what I'm indicating is we won't even have that flexibility that we had back with ASMFC, because we're going to have two managers that we're faced with, ASMFC and the South Atlantic Council. So I think we need to hear more as to what the expectations of everyone fishing are. We did have a conversation about the season today, and, you know, Ryan pointed out it can be a little bit more dangerous than ever because, let's just say, wave four, July and August, really, you know, for 2016, you had about the same amount of effort as May and June, but the harvest was closer to 70% of the total in that wave. So you could work on that premise and do some projections. The only problem is if fish move earlier, if cobia move earlier up into Virginia, while you think you're doing a great service by truncating part of wave four, it's lost in wave three. So we have to work on that a little bit more. Ryan hasn't done that yet. We have to look, you know, really 2013 is the first time that MRIP, the way it is, has really occurred. So you have, you know, a few years to work with to make these predictions, these forecasts. But, you know, we need to at least do that for the commission. The commission has to see certain options. This will mean 500,000 pounds. This will mean 300,000 pounds. That type of approach. I think last year we looked at 240,000 pounds as sort of an estimate of what that would take. We'll do things like that again. So, you know, we still have to do that.
But fundamentally you're talking about cutting back the number of days more or less proportional to where we are for overharvest to where we need to be next year.
We hope. The bad thing about MRIP data and the change, the way that a wave is looked at, every day is the same. And we all know that's not the case. Within a 60 or 61 day period, you can point out through probability functions where higher harvests are going to occur in 61 days. But everyone has scrapped that and more or less said every day is the same. That compounds doing exactly what you're saying. But we'll still go through that, yes.
Yeah. And Tom, Pete. There
you go. What, I don't really want to sound completely stupid here, but I've got to blurt this out. What problem are we trying to solve?
We have
I understand that the harvest going up is alarming some folks. Are there recruitment problems or population problems, density problems that anyone is aware of? Is this a proactive thing instead of reactive?
This is reactive to the quota or the ACL, the annual catch limit. So there's an annual catch limit for the recreational fishery of 600.
But the point I'm trying to make is...
But we don't know the rest. You saw the slide up there.
Right,
at the mine.
But
it ended in 2011. That's the problem we're in. If we had an updated assessment, then we could answer.
That's what I mean. How, why are we doing all this without an assessment?
Well,
just that's why I said this is a proactive thing to a reactive thing.
I think you would call this proactive. You know, we know we're going to change direction in 2018.
I mean, are we seeing a similar thing here to what we were just talking about flounder and everything? And croaker and whatnot?
Well, it's not like that. I mean, there's plenty of indications that flounder have recruitment problems.
Right, but what I'm talking about is the moving northward of different...
No, the progression is pretty similar. It's just the timing of when the fish move.
Well, whatever.
Then so that could change, and right. That's why it could be dangerous to suggest to the commission as one option, okay, you went to August 30th last year, just go to August 1st, because what could happen is if the movement's earlier, we could load up
right
earlier too. So yeah, it's a bad situation made complicated by the lack of recent science. It really is.
No, well, that's what it sounded like to me.
But if you talk to the fishermen, there's plenty of cobia. But if you talk to the scientists, they're stuck back at 2011. When the stock was trajecting downward, the spawning stock biomass. So,
yeah, okay.
I think everyone here pretty much knows that part so far.
So if we were cutting days out of the season, could you have someone before everybody gets up here and speaks so they know what you're looking at? At least do a thumbnail of we're looking at cutting the number of days by 50% or something?
No, because... I think the most important thing that we faced last year was that we as a staff were willing to say, okay, the feds are going to close June 20th. I think it happened really the 23rd. And, you know, the commission should look at that, and that's probably what to do. This year is a little bit different. The feds have already closed federal waters. I think everyone understands that it would be very, very difficult to come after Virginia. I'm going to say that. There's preemptive authority that the National Marine Fisheries Service could exercise, but it hinges on the fishery being prosecuted mostly in federal waters. That's not the case when you have over 80% in state waters. So I think it's open, Tom. It's not that we wouldn't like to tell the committee tonight exactly what we're thinking, but we really have to wait and work on a little bit more. And I think it's going to help to hear, maybe we hear a little bit differently than we heard last year. I think last year the anglers and the charter boat folks and everyone else felt like they were, you know, in a situation that they knew they had to push back as hard as they could. So we'll see what happens this year.
Well, is that the reason for ASMFC getting involved in it now?
Yeah, ASMFC is involved not only for that, but also because the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council wants ASMFC right. involved, and so does National Marine Fisheries Service. The problem with that could be a problem. The problem with that is that one agency's going to set the quotas, and the other has to abide by them, and we're sort of in the middle. So
what we would like to hear from the fishermen today is how would a season affect you, or what recommendations or suggestions do you have as far as we can argue.
Brian had a slide on there, so I think what we're looking for is
we've asked the same question.
Probably some information. If I can get back there, Ryan, on your length and everything else there. Where's your length? Length and your possession length and all that.
This one?
Yeah, there you go.
An inch, no? Let's do it.
Where's the 40 inches and one fish over 50 and two fish vessel limit?
This one?
There we go.
Yeah.
So that's talking points right there.
Yeah, but we have to reduce from that, and they have no clue as to what you're...
Well, they're going to have to talk about season. I mean, everyone's identified that. I mean, but
I'm not so sure there won't be those who think that was pretty harsh last year. I mean, we're just getting back together after a little hiatus, so we need to hear from everybody, okay?
All right, we need to hear any suggestions that you are. We need to hear how bad a cut is going to be to you folks. We.
Can I have this job? Because I can damn sure do it better.
Now. There's going to be some discussion. I know some of you want to talk about the science. There's not a whole lot that we can do about it. If you have some suggestive points about what the VMRC can do to stand up for Virginia and have some get some better ideas out of or to argue the science better, if we, Jonathan, I know you have some. If we can make it brief, but tell us where you think there's room to argue the science, but briefly. And then, as for the fishermen, we need to know how you can cut without doing any more harm than necessary, because it's going to have to happen. It's not going to be up to us to say we can fish all we want to fish and catch all we want to catch. The federal government's not going to let us do that. And hopefully when the AS, I'm looking forward to the ASMFC getting it, because we'll get a quota at that point, I hope, and we'll be able to decide how to manage that to that point. But that's a year or two down the road at the minimum. So, Jonathan, I'm going to let you go first, but if you'll tell us and then we'd like to hear from everybody else, please.
Sorry, sir, I don't know your name, but you asked a question earlier. I'll start out by answering.
If you'd identify yourself.
I'm sorry, I'm Jonathan French from Falls Church, Virginia. You asked the question, so what are we working towards with this? The reality is we're working towards it into a gerrymandered box.
Now, listen, that was a rhetorical question, if you get my drift. I wanted Rob to tell me what we were, because there's no data to back any of this up.
Well, the zone split research was done by two scientists from South Carolina DNR. They talked about Tanya Darden, R. Darden, and Matthew R. Denson. That was non-peer reviewed paper that was submitted to CDAR 28 within about the same time, actually published on November 6, 2013. The same two scientists published in the National Marine Fisheries Bulletin, Population Genetics of Copia, Implications for Fisheries Management Along the Coast of Southeastern United States. And I quote, on the basis of microsatellite data from collections along the U.S. Atlantic coast, offshore groups were genetically homogenous. However, there were two sampled inshore aggregations for South Carolina and Virginia that were genetically distinct. I'm happy to provide this study for everybody. South Carolina and Virginia having unique populations. The study goes on to say that South Carolina has a unique population because of stock there. It was essentially an invasive species that was eradicated, and the folks from South Carolina have been pushing these cuts for other states as a way to try to backfill the destruction of that invasive local population and satisfy the concerns of their fishermen. And it's kind of bit them in the behind, because now they don't have a season as a result of some of that action. But these are the same two scientists saying that offshore migratory population, because they go out of their way to say specifically that South Carolina population, they've never reported a caught fish with that genetic profile outside of South Carolina waters. They don't track. At the very least, it says very clearly that there's one offshore migratory population of fish. That may change when science comes around, but this is peer-reviewed research. It says the fish in the Gulf and the Atlantic are the same body, except for these two unique inshore aggregations, only one of which they have a substantial amount of samples. And this study is written by the exact same people who said the exact opposite in the CDAR report. That's been our assertion all along, that this zone split, which if you, again, I know that they've mentioned that if you add Florida back in, the numbers may not be identical, but using the 2014 numbers that we worked under, this overage is only about 90,000 pounds. And we're going to talk a little bit more about Virginia. So you talked about recommendations. I'm going to skip past most of my presentation because there are a lot of people here that want to talk. But I do want to talk about why cutting a week, cutting a month, or whatever out of season doesn't work if MRIP is the ultimate calculator. Doug Mumford, who just recently retired from North Carolina's marine fisheries folks, provided a couple of us with a week-by-week scrub on all the catch data. And Rob can tell me if I'm right, but as I understand it, harvest under the A column is fish actually seen by an interviewer, correct? Fish under the B1 column are fish that were reported killed but were not actually seen by the interviewer. So, again, why does taking time off not work? Well, in week 28, which I believe is July 8th through the 14th, there was zero fish observed by the interviewers. Three were reported killed but not observed by the interviewers. There are lots of weeks with similar patterns in terms of what was reported on the intercepts, very similar numbers. However, for that week, somehow that three fish was turned into 14,525 fish, or 24 fish landed. By my math, assuming about a 35-pound fish average with the 40-inch limit, and this is just in Virginia, that's 507,000 pounds of fish. That means if that week it happened on May 15th, season's closed after 1 week. The closures don't make sense, and given that this ACL has been created under the most dubious of statistical data efficacy situations, I just, not in good conscience, can we support this going forward? I realize the ASMFC is going to be taking over or doing complementary management, which, as they said, means South Atlantic's going to say, here's the quota, split it up between the states. Until that quota gets situated properly, we're going to have an issue. And you also spoke about global warming being a pattern. While we're seeing this trend of fish going catches going way, way, way up in Virginia significantly over the last 3 years, Florida's numbers are going down. East Florida's quota was 880,000 pounds approximately that was handed over to the Gulf total. But in East Florida, it's still measured under the South Atlantic framework on the website that you were looking at earlier for catch. And if my numbers are correct, Florida caught, let's see here, I think it's 332,000 pounds approximately, and they were allotted 880. It seems like the problem with the population going down is Florida. And as far as I know, there's still two fish per person per day. So we're bearing the brunt of good regulatory management practices, and our population is thriving. That's not grounds for good management. So here's what I ask. North Carolina recently approved that they're going to have a full season through August 31st. They're going to allow four fish caught at 36 inches. That's fork length, not total, per boat per day. They've removed the allocation by sector. So last year they had some rules where if you were a normal recreational boat person, you could only keep fish Monday, Wednesday, Saturday, and you could only keep two. Charter boat guys got to fish all week and keep four. They've removed that this year, and I support. I do not support sector allocation differences. To me, it's a violation of equal protection, especially for recreational harvest for a low encounter species. I think anything less than that coming as a recommendation of this group would be criminal. And I realize that's more. That's more. But I just showed you what, you know, somehow three fish turned into 14,000. And then if you look at those numbers, as MRIP looks at them by averaging out to week to come up with the totals, if the average fish was approximately 35 pounds, and if the angler success rate was approximately 25%, and I've seen these numbers, I don't have the hard ones in front of me, but I think that's pretty close to being accurate. That means that 1,000 fishermen, not boats, we were confused about that last year, but fishermen, so approximately 300 boats, targeted cobia every day in the Chesapeake Bay from May 15th to August 31st, regardless of wind, weather, whatever. I'll let the other captains talk about whether that's credible. I'm not out on the water. I'm a weekend guy. But that's not what I've seen. To me, if 20 boats are at York Spit, it feels crowded, and I kind of want to go somewhere else. Intermiddle grounds, 30 or 40 boats doing circles, people are running into each other. I think that there's an active participation, as you can see by the folks in this room, but it's a very niche fishery. It's something that requires a lot of equipment and a lot of focus and preparation to be successful at. And that limits participation, especially given the restrictions last year. I also don't think it's credible that there's not the assumption that, that effort was actually driven down by the restrictions last year. The other item is the GAF issue. I think that was articulated well by Rob and his team. As someone who's a regular pier angler, and I admit I fish from a pier mostly in North Carolina, and we do drop net for red drum. They're pretty hardy, but red drum stay still in the net. So when you're taking the red drum out of the net, the chances for the angler to get hurt, much less than the fish, if you know what you're doing, pretty safe. Cobia, not so much. You're going to get hurt. So the guys who are fishing off Buckrow, I worry about them. From a boat perspective, I've heard mixed things from everybody about net only. I will say this. Even if you go beyond the public health standpoint, it became a de facto $150 tax on everybody who wanted to go cobia fishing that may not have had a net before but used a gaff that wasn't required. I'm opposed to a net-only requirement and ask the committee to make that recommendation. Again, I have two genetic studies. I'm more than happy to share them with you for your own review. Draw your own conclusions, but based on those genetic studies, the last recommendation I'd ask that you make is to call on VMRC to ask the Attorney General to file suit similar to what's happened with some of the commercial sectors in the Northeast against National Marine Fisheries Service. Even by MRF's own calculation, the closure, if it had happened last year on June 20th, would have resulted in $11 million of damage to the Commonwealth, and I think that that number is grossly underestimated. And if it was done in a manner that doesn't follow the national standards in the MSA, that should be addressed. And as you'll recall, three of the members of the Chesapeake Bay Congressional delegation wrote a letter to VMRC last year that was read in the May meeting that said they did not believe that National Marine Fisheries Service had acted in accordance with the national standards as required with the Magnuson-Stevens Act. I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you all for the time and your patience this evening.
If you just make sure that the VMRC gets your comparisons, I'd appreciate it. And thank you for your time. Any questions from anybody?
Which the breakdown of the numbers?
The genetic study. All right, is there anyone else who would like to speak? Yes, sir. If you come up, give us your name and who you represent, if you're with a group.
I think I had to go after Jonathan last year, too. Makes me sound like a hillbilly. My name's George Head. I live in Yorktown. I'm going to refer to my chicken scratch here that I've been jotting down, try to stay somewhat on track. I've been cobia fishing in the bay for about 30 years. And I've been chartering for about the last 10. And my charter business has been built around the cobia fishery and relies on the cobia fishery. Almost 100% of my trips are targeting cobia. And I'm just giving you my personal opinions. I think a lot of the other captains are going to have different opinions than I do. But I was real concerned last year. We went to much more restrictive regulations than we've ever dealt with in the past, the two fish. But in honesty, it really didn't hurt my business a whole lot going to two fish. We stayed real busy all summer. I like the one fish over 50 inches to help protect the breeding stock. I do feel like if it became any more restrictive than that, it would start to hurt business. Obviously, we would all like a full season like North Carolina has and like we've enjoyed for years up until 2016. You know, I think personally in my business, I could take a week off at the beginning or a week off at the end, but you know, anything more than that would really start to affect business and the income that my family relies on for the summer that we rely on for this charter fishery. We put an awful lot of money into this fishery, a lot of specialized equipment on the boat. And I think, you know, a lot of the guys in the audience know I'm pro-conservation for any species of fish. I want these fish to be around for years for our kids. But I only support conservation if it's based on reliable science. And I'm not a scientist. I'm not nearly as informed as Jonathan. But I researched it as much as I could last year when we got into this situation. And it was really mind-blowing, the lack of good science that it seemed like they were using, the low intercepts that MRIP was giving us during the summer, just a handful of fish. They weren't even weighing the fish. They were getting the weights from somewhere else. I was asking all kinds of questions. I was getting inconsistent answers from VMRC and MRIP and everybody I talked to. And it just didn't sound like they had their act together. It didn't sound like they were using good data. Even when you go back to the 2012 stock assessments and the split, I was getting contradictory information. There was some science that was saying this and some saying that. I mean, if that's not accurate, I mean, the 600,000 pounds that we're dealing with for the whole East Coast is, you know, out the window. It's not reliable. So I'm all for conservation. I want these fish to be around. I can live with a 2 or 3 fish boat limit in the short term. I would hope that in the long term, maybe we could go to something a little less restrictive once we get some better science. I hope it doesn't get any more restrictive than that this year for 2017. So I ask you to give us as much season as you possibly can. And something similar maybe, or a little more lenient to what we were dealing with last year. I know that I'm not in agreement. I'm kind of in the minority with the netting thing. But I have no problem netting these fish. My son was my full-time mate last year, and he netted every single fish that came in our boat. We never had a single incident. You do need a specialized net. You need a big net, big heavy-duty net for these big fish. But when you net them and they're in the net, you can take your time getting them in the boat from the water. They relax in the net. You get them in the net. You can measure them, take your pictures, do what you want, and kill the fish and keep it or release it safely. We've used gaffs for years. I've seen gaffing is an art in itself. There's some really good guys on the gaff. A lot of them are out here in the audience, but a lot of these weekend guys don't have the art mastered, and I've seen a lot of fish come off the gaff, and there's probably some mortality there. In my opinion, you're going to need a net on your boat anyway, unless you're going to just quit after you catch that 150-inch fish and go home, because if you catch a second fish over that, you've got to net that fish anyway. So I don't really see an issue there either way. I think if it helps in our cause, in our favor, to keep the netting, I don't have a problem with that. I would like to ask VMRC, I know the final decision is a month away, to not spring any last-minute surprises on us. I know you guys have asked for what they have in mind, and I just don't want to not have an opportunity to contradict or express our concerns with whatever they decide to.
Everyone should be here on March 28th, so that's when the final decision is right? They're kind of bringing it on. Now you're leading up to that, because we're hoping to have a March meeting on that too, right?
If you wish.
The final thing is, you know, I think in the last five, this is a developing fishery. I do think it's getting more pressure than it's had in the past. The whole fishery has changed with the sight fishing. But, you know, for the last 5 or 10 years as this sight fishing has developed, the Virginia stock that we see out there on a daily basis seems very healthy. It seems very consistent. We're seeing the same amount of fish year after year after year. It doesn't seem to be declining. There's a little concern with the top end size of the fish. Those really big 90, 100 pound fish we're not seeing in the numbers I think we used to, but the numbers of fish seem as good or better than they ever have been here in the bay.
Okay. Yes, Tom.
I've got one question for you and everybody else who comes up here. If we're going to take days out of the season, it'll be at a one end or the other. For you as a businessman, which end is the least painful? For keeping your boat chartered?
I'm a little different than some of these guys. I'm a school teacher, and I get out early June, and I go back late August. So, a little bit on either end is not going to affect me too much. The fish are more, I think are more susceptible to fishing pressure later in the summer when they're schooling up, leaving the bay. They're on all the structure. I guess that's that wave four that Rob's talking about. I think as far as helping the giving the fish a break later in the summer would probably help a little bit, but maybe a little off each end. I mean, I don't know. It's going to affect business. These guys start booking charters beginning, you know, late May, early June, and right on through September if they could. So, you know, it's going to hurt either way, but I don't know which one would hurt more.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Got a question?
Yes, sir.
You said you've been fishing about 30 years and chartering for 10, and your son was your mate this past year, right?
Correct.
How many fish do you think you caught this year, roughly?
Probably in 300, somewhere in that ballpark.
And how old is your son, and how big is he? What size?
He had just turned 13 last summer. He's 14 now. He's getting ready to turn 15. He's 14 right now, but he was a young 14 last summer. His birthday's in May.
And he's
small. He's probably 100 pounds, a little over 100 pounds last summer. He's 120 now.
So he netted 300 fish roughly, a 13-year-old, 14-year-old, around 100 pounds, and didn't have any safety issues.
No safety issues. We didn't lose fish at the net. He was very good at it. It wasn't an issue at all for us.
No one on the boat got hurt.
Over gapping. I had another mate that was an excellent gaffer, 200 pounds. He's gapped probably thousands of fish in his life. And before I switched over to my son, we had already switched over to netting the majority of our fish just because it was cleaner, not as much blood on the boat, not dealing with the mess and the slimy decks. And so we had gone to netting the fish even before my son started mating with us. I have no issue netting the fish. You do have to have a good $150 quality net. You can't net them with your average flounder net. But if you have a good net, I don't think it's that big of an issue.
You don't fish federal waters?
I do when you're allowed to late in the season.
Okay.
In August, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Majority of what we fish is in the bay.
All right. Thank you.
But all these guys fish federal waters, especially later in the season, August time frame.
Thank you very much for your information. Anybody else? Okay, gentlemen. Do you say? It's your name and who you represent.
Bill Gorn with Boat Up Lures. I've had the honor to represent several of the charter captains, tackle shops, recreational anglers, pier anglers, from northeastern North Carolina all the way up to Salisbury, Maryland. I've gone to the last three South Atlantic meetings. I, along with Wes Blow, are APs for Cobia on the South Atlantic. I had the fortunate job of looking over all of the science, and what we found was more than shocking. I'm also Rob O'Reilly's best friend. We get along great. No, but Rob's been good. We pushed Amendment 4 that's under public comment right now within the South Atlantic that reduces the Atlantic zone down to one fish per person at 36 inches. We went to 36 inches from 33 inches to give them another year to spawn, you know, trying to help that theorized declining stock biomass. But on that, you were talking about, is there a problem, is there a need with the stock? And the only thing that I could reference is the stock assessment had a success rate per trip under 10%. Wave 4 for us, it was 25%. So the abundance, in theory, was up just for that. And even Wave 4 at a, you know, we dissected the numbers. They are what they are. But if it's a 17.9 PSE, in theory, it should be the closest projection. And if you look at the history of catch totals for Virginia, at least 15 years, there's several years that are zero. In the Gulf and East Coast of Florida, we use a 15-year average at least to split or divvy up. And there was years where they were catching 2 million pounds. So, Jonathan ran over the science on the zone split. I can tell you, you know, you don't want to sit here and go back over it. I get it. And we're talking about cutting a season. For me, every week, as a lure manufacturer, every week that you cut, you're really cutting two. Because the tackle shop stopped buying 2 weeks before the season's out. Last year for Virginia, even picking up additional shops, I still had a 27% decrease in sales to Virginia. If that tells you, you know, what it did as far as people buying bucktails, either they weren't losing as many on pylons or breaking them off, or they were just buying less, or I've just made them that much better. But I hope to go down to the next, and I'll say this, the guys behind me and in North Carolina all donated for me to be able to go down there and be a voice, you know, for them. So it just shows you, you know, how much these guys care. I've tried to do my best. It's been, you feel like you win and then you lose, and then you win and you lose. I think at the end of the day, like many charter captains remind me, it feels like we're just losing. It's upsetting because I fish in the bay on average 15 to 25 days a year, and I have for the past 9 years. This past year with the fatback along the beach, the class of fish that we were encountering was healthy. Often being worried we were over 50, you know, more than we were under, but we were always within legal limits. I supported North Carolina reporting their fish. It's the only protective measure that we have. But what it boils down to is a VRMC staff willing to take that data and fight, and either fight as in the Atlantic States and say, hey, we're not catching that many. So we're not going to continue to reduce, because I always say fair and equitable. You got to remember the East Coast of Florida, where there's enough science on the books, on the records, peer reviewed, saying that offshore cobia from Virginia to Florida have high levels of intermixing as far as travel. Now, if you do it down to spawning time periods, we could argue the spawning study. Came down to one tournament in South Carolina in 1 month over 2 years. But there's eggs that have been captured throughout all 6 months of the spawning. You gotta remember, cobia is the second fastest growing fish known to man. It spawns every 4 to 7 days. They're a tough fish. I caught a fish last year that had been speared. Had other charter captains. There's actually multiple. Somebody was a bad gaffer in North Carolina, not Virginia, that they had caught fish that had been gaffed. I mean, they are tough fish. I think what the fishermen are asking for as far as the gaffing, I think what they don't want is a no-gaff rule. Have the ability. If anything, you should say you have to have a net. Because I agree, if you have low boat numbers, you're going to need a net. But for some charters, it really comes down to a boat layout. Is it easy? Is it not? I got hit pretty damn hard by a tail last year trying to get the damn bucktail out of a net because the hooks were so sharp. It went into the net. Fish were going crazy. It happens. But if anything, just give them the option because not every case is the same. But they do need a net on the boat because, again, you have a six-pack charter. If you can only keep four fish like you guys are going to vote for tonight, I know. There's going to be some releasing of fish. As far as the estimated season, in Virginia, it's the largest, we haven't got a real consensus. It's like you said, it's great unknown. North Carolina staff didn't recommend anything. but I can tell you we worked for hours with them to come up with something that worked for everybody. As far as the start date, the end date, there were some guys that lost out on that September fishery. But I would disagree with Ryan. I would say they should work the numbers. They're so outrageous. You should work it. If there's a week that's 450,000 pounds and you want to cut a week, let's cut that week. And then you can go back to NIMS and say, hey, we cut 450,000 pounds. But if it was only that easy. But I think it is, honestly. And I've spoke with Roy. I've been at the South Atlantic. They've been very accepting. I think there's some things with MRIP that are going to come out at this next meeting. I will again call for an emergency action. I can tell you before Amendment 4 was published, which when it is goes through its 30 days public comment period, write the final, and then there's supposed to be a 30-day cool-off, which I think they'll waive, but it'll give Georgia and South Carolina a season. Before that was published, it was overwhelming majority for emergency action because they figured Atlantic States isn't the answer. There's no cure-all. I understand we'll have a season, but it's 4 weeks, 6 weeks, really a season, you know, given all the information. So I'm going to leave it up to the guys to come up here and talk, because I think each person has a unique situation. But understand, most of the guys that I speak for, Lee Tippett, he comes down from Salisbury, Maryland, rents out a boat slip for a month, and cobia fishes. He's a very good cobia fisherman. People travel here. But remember, the more that's restricted from Virginia, the east coast of Florida still has a 365-day fishery. 365 days. I still contend that one state's failure to implement state regulations in their own waters shouldn't impact Virginia, who's been the leader in conservation for cobia.
Yeah.
The leader. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. Any questions?
But four per boat.
Four per boat. Okay, yes, sir. Please.
From Solomon's. They typically come from Solomon's.
I'm not going to go through all of everything I had because it would be kind of redundant, but I figured I'd give it to you. And you
appreciate
can,
it.
I know all y'all can read, so.
Thank you.
It is a requirement.
It's in color, too.
My name is Patrick Link. I'm just a recreational fisherman that enjoys cobia fishing and kind of enjoys spreadsheets and numbers and all that nerdy stuff. So when I kind of started looking at this stuff, it drew me to it. I'm not going to go into numbers. We all know how bad MRIP is. But one thing I would like to talk about, we've been talking about kind of the economic factors that are kind of driving some of these decisions. NOAA had accepted $140 per angler as a rough number for a cobia trip. Based on MRIP numbers, since they like to use them, I figured we might as well. The primary trip data would represent about a $15.8 million fishery to Virginia. If you add in the secondary fishing mode, it's another $1.7 million. So you're talking about a significant economic driving factor to this area, the whole state, you know, as a whole, but just this area in particular, the Hampton Roads would feel it the most, I do believe. Another thing to keep in mind is that right now we are in the stage of data collection. So as you guys know, we've just in Virginia funded a genetic study, a tagging study, an economic study. So to shrink the season now would only alter the data that we can gather. Most of this data will be gathered by us, the recreational and charter fishermen. You had a room full of folks that wanted to participate and help at VIMS to help with this. If you keep shortening the season, you're going to lose that. And you're going to what you're going to do is you're going to create outlaws because people can only do but so much. And the more you shorten it, the more you're going to get folks that are just going to go back to their private docks. And that's the reality of it all. Not that we should manage based on the scare of people breaking the law, because breaking the law is breaking the law. But to act like that's not going to happen, I think, is pretty unrealistic. So in this time of gathering data, I think that, you know, the best thing we could do would be at minimum status quo. Last year, I think, you know, George just spoke about how it affected him, and some of these other guys will talk about how it affected their charter business. I don't do this to make a living, so I can't tell you how it affected me. All I know is I went out and saw as many fish as I've ever seen in the bay. I've been fishing for 10 years. I do agree that we're kind of seeing a little bit of a shift towards the smaller to middle-sized fish, which would lead me to believe that we're having recruitment, that we've got fish coming back into the system. And maybe that northern boundary shift is something that can be looked at. So my recommendation, and based only on the fact that I feel like accepting anything less would be accepting this data that I've looked at that is just so crazy. We were already the most restrictive of any state. I feel like the one fish per person and six per boat was what we had before would be the only thing that we can do, and then look ourselves in the mirror and say, you know, we're doing what's right for the stakeholders, because there is no way we can look at this. And I know that we're being held to standards by the federal government, but I'm hoping that maybe we have somebody in here like that New Jersey governor that said what he had to say about the situation, because it's a mess. And to act like it's not a mess is just putting your head in the sand. So that's my recommendation. The gaff, I netted a pile of fish this year, and it didn't bother me one bit, but I don't necessarily believe in restricting folks, you know, unwarranted. I could go either way. It really doesn't make a difference to me. So attached in this is one, a map. And this is something to think about, but that line is where they're talking about the genetic split, where the mixing zone would have been. You can see how much of East Florida should really be part of what we are managing, yet we're not. And then the last three pages is the Virginia tagging data that I haven't heard a lot of folks talk about. I'm sure you guys may have been privy to this the last go around when I wasn't here. But the one thing that stood out to me was, you know, obviously 12% of the recaptures were in North Carolina. But then the next state was Florida. So my question would be, or my, I don't know, I guess hypothesis would be, maybe it has something to do with the Gulf Stream. Or, I mean, we just don't know much, but we're starting to learn. So to restrict now is not the answer, if you ask me. I think if anything, you support the folks here that are showing up to these meetings and trying to do research and care about the fishery, and also push for some representation for us at South Atlantic. I don't think we have the proper representation there, and hopefully listen to these folks that probably have a little bit more stake in it than I do, but just. But please do listen to what they have to say. They're all going to tell you the same thing. I would imagine that they're seeing more fish than they've ever seen. So we don't have an issue with that. We have an issue with bad data. So that's it.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the?
I appreciate it.
Hi, we
on the you said something about the tagging that 12% are from North Carolina and the rest are Florida.
No. 12% of the recaptures were recaptured. They were tagged in Virginia and recaptured in North Carolina. The next state after that was Florida. There was six recaptures in Florida.
Susanna has told me in the past it's like 80% in North Carolina and Virginia of recaptures out of cobia tagged in Virginia.
I mean, I don't know. You can...
It would still add up.
Yeah.
80% of the total, very little is recaptured beyond North Carolina.
That's correct. Yeah, I think that if you look at the percentage, it's like less than 1% of the total, and that was out of the data set I had, which was 2015 to from 1995 to 2015, I believe, or something along those lines. Lewis provided it, but yeah, I mean, you can see it in there. I can send out a bigger breakdown of it, but I have it all broken down.
So obviously, you've looked at the data.
And yeah,
34 fish
that counted for all these?
Yes.
Were they geographically focused? And the secondary question was, were the dockside interviews geographically skewed? The striped bass years ago, when I looked into it for wave six, like 90% of the interviews were Hampton and south. But a lot of the effort happens up in the rivers and everything where they're going to be catching smaller fish, so the weight, the harvest gets skewed to heavier fish. Whereas if they're focusing the dockside interviews, get focused on areas where people are landing cobia, say Back River and Lynn Haven or wherever, and not getting interviews, not distributing the interviews more equitably, which MRIP was supposed to fix that. I don't know how successful they've been.
They can fix it because they're the ones doing the MRIP data.
Well, that can easily skew the data to or the reported harvest. So you realize the importance of making sure that they get a uniform a distribution that is more consistent. Well, that is more consistent with the pressure.
And they made alterations in two ways: the way they cluster low pressure sites, and the way they weight an actual fish interview from a low pressure site. In fact, it's a heavier weight. That's weighted heavier because they assume it's less likely to occur. So an interview of Crab Creek does not work as much. It's not weighted as heavily as one from one of your upriver sites that during the time of the year when its pressure rating is up one. It's very low. There is some.
Cobia is such a low intercept species that, to me, the obvious answer is the self-reporting and then us standing by, having folks that'll stand behind that data and fight for it when the time comes. I mean, we've seen it with bluefin tuna. You've seen it with some other species where if you have the data, you can do that. You just have to be willing to do that and not be willing to lose flounder because you're going to lose because you want to fight for cobia. And all of the backroom dealings that go on with that stuff that is beyond my, But that's where we're at, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, I don't think, sadly. But
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Anybody else? Mike? I'm sorry, gentlemen. Yeah, go ahead, Mike. No, we got a couple.
So I'm Mike Avery. I'm the president of the Virginia Saltwater Sport Fishing Association. We have about a little over 600 members, and we're growing still every day. I'm also a charter captain on the side that does fish for cobia. Mr. Chairman, you suggested that we were concerned that unless we take action, the federal government may take action and make our cuts for us. I would suggest to you the FMAC committee and the BMR staff position ought to be, let them do it. Let's do what's right for the Virginia anglers and the Virginia citizens. And that's to tell the federal government that we simply don't accept your MRIP numbers. They're just way too incredulous. They're just way too far out there. There's not any angler I've talked to that has believed any of the numbers coming from MRIP. So that's point one. And point two is you've heard about the zone split and the unfair practices by the South Atlantic Council by doing this zone split, by giving a single state on a single coast, East Florida, more quota than the rest of the entire Atlantic is just simply grossly unfair. And we as citizens of Virginia ought to say that's unfair, and we don't accept that. And I remind you that I'm talking about just East Florida. There's also a Gulf side of Florida, too, that has more access to the Gulf quota. So how is it fair that a single state has way more access to these fish than the entire Atlantic coast does? So that was all grossly unfair. So I would suggest that our actions in Virginia ought to be to say to the federal government, to these councils, your practices are unfair, and we simply don't accept them. And I think the FMAC ought to send that message. Now, I will say I'm a little disappointed that we don't even have a quorum here today. So you can't even make a motion. I don't know what the rules of order say about getting votes over email or voice if they're not here in the meeting. So I guess that almost forces you to have a March FMAC meeting to have a position prior to the next commission meeting. Let me talk about the gaffing issue just for a second. Almost every captain I've talked to, not just charter captains, recreational anglers, all opposed to not having to the gaff prohibition, that you got to give us our gaff back. What happens is, and I would not even categorize it as a safety issue on the boat. I mean, there may be that, but I've never experienced personally a safety issue using a net. But what happens is when you bring a net into the water the size of this podium and you have a large fish coming at you, oftentimes when that, as soon as you put that big black net in the water and they see that, a large cobia that's still green is going to have two or three or four more strong runs in him. And he's going to turn around and he's going to peel out a bunch more line. And I've personally lost not many, but a handful of nice fish during those extra runs as they turn and sometimes they tail walk across the water, which is fun for the angler, but that's often the time that you might lose the fish. So I'd like to just kind of see a show of hands, especially those that aren't going to talk here. How many of you want to see your gaff back? So there's your numbers, Mr. Chairman. The majority, and so what I would suggest to this committee is, let's not punish the masses because there's a few anglers that aren't properly handling a gaff. Yeah, there's a handful of anglers who can't use a gaff and they may harm a fish, but that's such a vast minority of anglers. So let's not punish the mass of the anglers because they can't use a gaff. Most of us know how to use a gaff. We can, when the fish, as soon as it comes beside the boat, we dispatch the cobia quickly in the boat, and it's a caught fish. And it's done safely, and it's no issue. So we don't have any trouble estimating the size. If we even suspect it's an undersized fish, we grab the net. So, yes, we still have to have a net. And every cobia fisherman is still going to bring a net, and they're still going to, because if it's an undersized fish, we're going to net it. We're not going to gaff them. And most of us know, if he's even any question in size, we net the fish. So my recommendation to the FMAC committee is your position should be to bring back the gaff. Don't punish the masses because there's a couple of anglers in Virginia who don't know how to use a gaff. On the season and numbers of fish, we don't yet have a position established within VISA. So our position is the same as it was last year. One per person, up to six per boat, and no close season. We may be able to whittle that down as we talk to our members as we approach the commission meeting. But that was our last formal position within VISA going in. And that's the federal limit. So, again, we're talking about going under the federal limit when we start talking about going under that. And so our position is that the federal government, the councils, have not made their case of why Virginia should cut our seasons or our fish. Okay. So that's pretty much all I have, so thanks a lot.
All right, we appreciate it. Thank you. Any questions for Mike? All right, thanks, Mike.
Mr. Chairman, before he gets up here, Rob, do you have any idea what the real numbers are between...
No, come on.
You know, come on up. Between the 300 and some thousand and the 900 and some thousand, is there any idea of reality in there?
I haven't really looked at it, Ryan. I'm not going to pass the buck to Ryan, but I think MRIP, the only thing to say about MRIP is it's a big improvement from where we were.
Improvement.
And now what they're doing with MRIP, just so everyone understands this, if you haven't heard, there will be in 2018
boats fishing, you have your shore, your private rental, and then you have your charter party. Depending on which mode it was, the estimates of the amount of effort is 3 to 6 times higher than was thought. And Tom mentioned it, the coastal household calls that they were making. So MRIP started last year and goes this year when they have a side-by-side survey, a mail survey and a phone survey. And they already know it's going to change all the data. So what that means is all these stock assessments you hear about, these mathematical stock assessments, they're going to have to be redone. Allocation between commercial and recreational, there'll be a big, you know, hootenanny over that. There already is for summer flounder. So a lot's going to change in 2018. That's the only good reason that the stock assessment for cobia being pushed back, so we won't know the results of 2019. That's about the only case where I think maybe that's not too bad. But, you know, MRIP, if you dissect it, depends on how fine you dissect it. If you saw Ryan's chart, last year everyone said who was smart about MRIP said, hey, the proportional standard error is like 39%. That means the data aren't very tight. They're not very precise, and that's not good. Well, this year they're like 17.9 or 18%. So it says good precision. So I asked a question last meeting I was in, well, what does that really mean? Because usually you think you get more samples. The more samples you get, the more precise is the data. We had less samples in 2016. A fish that Jonathan French talked about than we did in 2015. So, no, Pete, I can't really tell you where it lies.
Well, I tell you why I ask. I feel like I'm looking at one of these hurricane charting maps. you know how accurate they are.
The only problem is, and you heard it with black sea bass earlier tonight, and you heard it with summer flounder, and you're hearing it with cobia, someone said, those are the numbers. And that's the problem that we face in that they take commercial census data. We have mandatory reporting, as you know, for many years. It's not perfect, but pretty good data. And then they use an approach to capture the recreational fishery, which is much different than census data. And then they homogenize those. I'll use those. Lewis likes to say they put it in the black box, but they homogenize those and they apply the effort to it for the recreational data. So it's a struggle. It's a struggle. Now, Dr. Jones from ODU just gave a presentation. The National Resource Council had to review MRIP. And they did that. It's on the web somewhere. You can find it. I heard the presentation. Luis Barberi from Florida and Dr. Cynthia Jones from ODU. And, you know, they seem to think it's fairly good. But the one question that came up was, can you manage quotas, recreational quotas, with MRIP? And Dr. Barberi started to say, well, no, not really. And Dr. Jones said, not in season. So MRS and MRIP, it's fine. They used to say with MRS, we only want to look at the trends. You can't use these to manage quotas. Now we're managing quotas. For many, many species, we're managing quotas. And if you think the winter crab dredge survey, like we all wait around until April for those results, it's the same thing with MRIP. Everyone left the meeting about black sea bass thinking it was probably not even going to be 8% payback. Well, now it's 24.9. And some really high numbers that you saw. New York had
And that's
more,
based on MRIP.
Yeah. New York had more pounds of fish in wave 6 than it did the previous 10 years combined. So yeah, it's...
You know, for everybody in here that doesn't know me, I've been on this committee since 1986. I asked to get off a number of years ago, and I've been privileged to been asked to attend for somebody else on both of these meetings, of all things. And it's like this is just a rerun on steroids from last year.
Okay. Tom, you have a question?
Yeah, I just want to clarify something you said, Rob.
That's fine.
The what you're saying about effort.
Yes.
what they're seeing now for the preliminary is that the MRIP is going to show less effort or more effort than
three times as much.
Higher.
How can they do that?
What the estimates are. Because
that means
county household, ever since there was the cell phone.
They're averaging 10 trips per fisherman, and now you're talking 60.
Yeah.
I mean, how many recreational fishermen are like I was last year and went twice because I had other things going on in life?
A lot.
Yeah, I mean, and we've only got 250,000. I mean, why are we doing the angler registration and the license combined if that doesn't give us a good handle on the number of fishermen and who to call? I've had that. I got the list for the phone number list and did a random survey three times, random cut of the data three times, and at least half the phone numbers match the names when you look them up on reverse lookups. So that's a great list to go get some survey data from.
You did that. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, stay tuned. That's all I can tell you.
But they're going to mail rather than call.
Right.
Which means the people who... But when you go to mailing, the people who go once a year are just going to throw it away. Whereas the guy who's a serious fisherman who might get out 30, 40 trips a year, he's going to fill it out because he thinks it's important. So you're going to skew the data to the people who fish a lot.
Thank you, Tom. Yes, sir. Please.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, I hear you. It's not something to look forward to.
All right. Good evening, guys. Chris O'Brien. I'm a charter captain out of Norfolk, Virginia, hydrologic sport fishing. So instead of, you know, running a whole spiel, you know, you guys have heard a lot of people talk. I endorse Jonathan French's comments. And a lot of other people's as well, but let's just get down to the meat of it. You were talking about being proactive or reactive. We're 100% reactive right now. This is a non-issue. This cobia fishery right now is healthy. So I've been fishing the bay for 10 years. As a charter captain, I'm going to my fourth year, and it is consistent. You see, same number of fish, catch the same number of fish, upwards of 300, just like Captain George had, all sizes. You know, majority are in that, you know, 37 to 45 inch class, healthy stock. I also participated in the tagging program, and I took DNA samples last year for VIMS. So I am a conservationist. I do care about this fishery as well as every other fish in the Chesapeake Bay. And if it was overfished, I would be the first one to raise my hand and say, let's shut it down. That's not the case.
Well, the point I was trying to make is it seems like to me, other than what you said, the regulators are trying to be proactive about something that doesn't exist.
Exactly.
We shouldn't be having this conversation right now.
Right.
What was done last year, you know, it was, I guess it was necessary, you know, but it worked. It worked for the fish. It worked for the BMRC. It worked for the fishermen. So let's let the process work.
Yeah. I mean, how many people in here, just out of curiosity, would go along with another year of status quo?
Don't touch it. It'll work. I think that's the general consensus. I mean, you see that hand. If you take away a week or a month of our fishery, you're taking away dollars. And this isn't like, oh, we just do this for fun. I mean, we're paying bills.
Yeah.
I mean, we're living off of this. So every week, you talk about, like, we got to do something. We got to take some days away. You don't have to. Because then you're taking money off our bottom line. That's like saying, hey, guys, I'm going to take $10,000 off your salary. Are you cool with that? Who's cool with that? Nobody.
I don't have a salary, but...
You know what I mean. So, I mean...
Yeah.
I mean, the point is... I
cut your Social Security.
The point is, nothing needs to be happening. Nothing needs to happen. I have over 500 hours on the water every year. So I want to open it up to you guys to ask me questions of what I see. The numbers... I mean, we know MRIP is obsolete at this point. It's obsolete. I mean, unfortunately, it's affecting us now because that's the driver behind this whole thing. MRIP is the driver. Those numbers are what are driving this whole process.
Yep.
And it's obsolete. I mean, there's no, you know, validity with it. And I think you guys should take your staff's recommendation at projected harvest at 333,000 pounds. I mean, that seems way more believable and accurate. So
thank goodness.
If you guys have questions for me, you know, please ask. anything.
I'm good. Thank you.
So, I mean, I already gave my recommendation. I think we...
I have a question for you.
Sure.
How many guys are out there like you and Jordy who are fishing 200 days, or, yeah, catching 200-300 fish a year in charters?
There's four of them right there.
Well, there's four of them. I'm just,
these
I mean,
the best guys in the Bay. These are the best guys.
15 or 20. Okay.
Give
because
a snapshot of the guys that are catching.
Because I look at it as regular Joe recreational fishermen, they'll be lucky to catch five a year.
Right.
Yeah. You know, yeah, or something like that.
We do better than other anglers.
Oh, yeah, I know. But what I'm trying to, what I was trying to get a feel for is, are there 100 charter boat captains doing that? In which case,
the
MREP number is probably accurate. Or are there's 20,
so
that's a different number.
I'll say this and this is on the record, and I would say this under oath. On a weekday charter, you'll see 15 to 20 boats out there. On a busy weekend, maybe 50. I mean, we're not even touching these numbers that are supporting this data. And this is no BS. I mean, 50 boats is a lot. If you go down the Baltimore Channel and you see 50 boats, I'm going somewhere else. I mean, you're not catching, it's too many boats.
Yeah.
And that's a lot. So 100, 200, 300, 400, 1,000, anglers, it's preposterous.
But what you're talking about is for 900,000 pounds is probably, what, 25, 30,000 fish?
27,000 plus.
Yeah. For the year. Across all anglers. And it's not unreasonable to be that could be a correct number, but I don't believe it either.
Appreciate it very much.
You're pretty damn good, I got to tell you that.
Oh,
27. Yeah,
thank you very much. It really helps. Anybody else?
You got to be doing that.
Okay, gentleman in blue shirt.
These guys got us. Well,
yep.
I feel they're going to run us, and now they start picking on them. I can't do no more to us.
I'm Austin Hain. I've been fishing Chesapeake Bay for like 10 years, Kobe about 6. I've been a charter captain for about the same as Chris, about 4 years. I'm quick with what I'm about to say because I pretty much agree with Jonathan French. I've backed him for ever since he started this whole petition or whatever he's doing. Just all of his information is good. I'm just going to break it down. As for you guys with the gaffing thing is a huge issue for me. I think we should be able to have gaffing. The netting is dangerous, I think. Not only is it hard, you lose a lot of fish, and if it's like cloudy and you're only fish for one fish, it's difficult. I mean, if you got to net the fish and you lose them, it's a heartbreak. As for a safety issue, not only is the fish going absolutely nuts when you get them in the boat, and a 50-pound fish, 60-pound fish in the boat going nuts is never good. If the bucktail comes out, that tangles in the net, and then as the fish, I've actually had this in my foot. Bucktail comes out of the fish, gets tangled up in the net. Fish is going nuts. The bucktail's flying around. You have a 2 ounce weight with a 11-ounce hook, 10-ounce hook, just going crazy on deck. And I've had that in my croc. I've had it in my shoes. As for
in my crocs, I thought it was for a fisherman croc for a pretty common shoe.
Anyway, that's my danger issue with it. It's you lose a lot of fish in nets, and I mean they get in your foot, As for what Chris was talking about with the 50 boats out there on a busy day, I don't even know if there's that many. I mean,
July 4th, there might be 50.
Maybe July 4th. But if I'm out there, and as most of you people know, I'm always moving fast. If there's, I'd say, probably 5 boats around me, I'm going to completely change locations by about, a couple miles. There's never more than... like they said, 50 boats in July 4th, ever. As for the fishery, I have not seen any decline. I don't know if I'm becoming a better fisherman, because every year it seems like it gets better out there. And I'm sure everybody else can agree with me on that. The bigger fish, I'm seeing those. They don't eat, just because that's the way Kobe are. The bigger they are, they just get harder to catch. But there are out there. I mean, we saw probably... May 14th, me and Chris ran across a 90-pounder, and people are talking about the big fish aren't around. We see them all the time. Just because you don't catch them doesn't mean that they're not there, but they're still around. Population's healthy. We see, 50, 60, 70 fish a day at some days if it's sunny. other than that, I mean, just whatever Jonathan French says, and you really can't, I mean, to build, I'm 26, I've built everything my whole life towards fishing. Like, I've loved fishing, and then I found out about Kobe. That took my love for fishing to the next level. To build something and make something of yourself at 26 and self-employed, to take that away from, you know, a lot of us guys that have built that around it, it's not fair. Because, I mean, what are we going to do? I can't go get a job, office job? Like, look at this. I can't do that.
No point me.
But the point being, like, we built this. We're proud of what we've done. We're self-employed. And for data that's just ridiculous, and it's so frustrating that we can't prove it to you guys.
Yeah.
It's just
starting this year,
I guess. But as it's just so blown out of proportion. The only thing that really just drives me insane is the amount of boats that you get, or not, just that people think are fishing out there. Just drives that's unbelievable, and the amount of fish that are getting caught. And he was saying that, you know, how many people catch 300 Kobe a year? That's, I mean, a little bit more than these guys in the room. We got some of the best Kobe fishermen in this room right now. An average guy, I mean, he'll see the fish. He ain't going to catch them. You got, you know, there's skill to it. This is a skilled fishery. But other than that, that's what I got to say. So
I really appreciate it. Any questions, anybody?
He doesn't want to be like Tom and get an office job.
Thank you very much. We really do appreciate it. Next, gentlemen.
Hello. My name is Zachary Hoffman. I run Salt Treated Fishing with my best friend John. A lot like Austin, I'm young. I've devoted everything I have into charter fishing. Last year, me and John ran about 125 trips. That's just cobia fishing. I have two boats that, you know, cobia pay for it. I got a mortgage, house, boat, trucks. Everything is paid for by cobia fishing. Same, and I live off of it, just like John does. So, y'all already know it. I don't even know how y'all can even preach this data or even take it into any kind of consideration, because it's definitely not correct. I just can't fathom how we can, for this number, we can take and change everything for what they're saying. Like, why can't we just do our thing when the right numbers get there, then act accordingly to the right numbers, instead of just taking these numbers they give us and just doing what we have to do, quote unquote, with them. So I support Jonathan French, Billy Gorm, everything they've said about it. I'd like to see, you know, four fish per boat would be great. The gaffing thing, I mean, we love to gaff, so it would be easier on our boat because we have a pretty big boat, and, you know, we deal with a lot of anglers that aren't good at angling, so with a gaff, you can reach out there and gaff them. You ain't got to worry about, like Mike Avery said, you got to sit there and fight in the boat. The fish turns around, runs away. You got to sit there and do that whole thing six times, lose your voice screaming at the people, and yada, yada, yada. Could just cut that all short. And I'd also like to add, you know, this whole thing is just, as far as booking-wise, I've been in business, this is going on my sixth year. And, you know, they say after the third year, your business is successful. If you make it 3 years, that's bull learning, because it seems like every year it's getting harder and harder, especially now with all this hot air in the air. Normally by this time, my booking, I'm already out May, almost in the middle of June, already booked, you know, with my recent clients and, you know, return clients. Well, people aren't doing nothing. I mean, they're waiting for all this stuff to take a roll before they even make a motion on it. So that already puts me on edge with having a mortgage, having everything else I got to pay for. I'm sitting here, like, pacing around. Okay, what are we going to do here? You know, my whole life, along with many other people in here, is at complete, just at the hands and mercy of what we do here in this room. Okay. I just feel like I'm violated, really. I mean, I feel like a 26-year-old that is self-employed, don't do drugs, works hard, and sitting here getting punished for some bull crap numbers is absurd. You know what I mean? If anything, you should be getting a medal. You know, especially this day and age, lazy people, you know what I mean? But that's all I got to say. I'm not a good public speaker, but...
You did fine.
Thank you very much.
All right, come on up. If anybody has anything else to say that's counter to what we've already heard...
No more school teachers, though.
Oh, okay.
Chris Martin.
Yeah, Chris.
I'm also a charter boat captain, ran 41 charters from June 15th to August 31st. Completely support Billy Gorrell and Jonathan Trench's recommendation. We would like to see a four-fish limit. We would not like a closure in the season. We're talking about financial impact on ourselves, but what we're not talking about is financial impact on the community, the marinas, the restaurants. I know over... 50% of the people that chartered me traveled to Tidewater. I know just because taxes are here, I spent $6,700 on gas in my marina for my charters. And we got to look at the big picture, how it's affecting everybody, not just our fishermen like myself and everybody in here, but the people that run the marinas, the tackle shops, the bait people, everybody, because everybody plays a role in that fishery. 90% of my business comes from the Cobia fishery. People travel from as far as I had people from Minnesota that came down just to catch a cobia here in Chesapeake Bay. And I think a short end of season, even if it was for a week, would have a dramatic financial impact, not only on our business, but other people's business. If people don't take in consideration, yeah, cobia are here from June, July, August, but it's a weather dependent fishery. So even if you cut a week out of there, you know, that might be the 1 to 5 days of the month that we have good weather we can actually go fishing for. Because not every day you can go out and cobia fish. So, you know, we're limited not only by the weather, so now if we get limited by time, it's going to restrict us even more. If we push a charter back, say, hey, we can't go today because it's 90% cloud cover, but how about Monday? Oh, we can't go Monday because we're closed that week. And we got to look at how that also affects our business, not only the weather. So take it away from when we can fish, is putting even more limitations on us financially and all the tackle shops, the businesses, everything else. And I'm sure everybody in here are getting people that are traveling and spending money in the community just to fish. Are they going to the other states? Yeah. But they're coming here, too, and they're spending a lot of money to go after those fish. And just even if you shorten that season at all, it's going to have a huge financial impact, not just on the charter business, but all the other businesses. Every single one of my clients, I would say every single one, I'd say close to 70, after they come in, go to the restaurant right there and eat dinner. Okay? They go to the tackle shop because they want to buy the equipment that we were using. So they go and they spend their money in the tackle shops. They buy those nice bucktails. And, you know, if they can't go fishing, if they can't catch them, they're not going to come here and spend the money. And when you start taking away people's wallets, you know, it affects everybody, not just the fishermen. So, 100% support a four fish, no closure of season as far as the gaff goes. I would, you know, much rather have the season and the fish. If I can't gaff them, that's fine. But I'd much rather take the time and the ability to catch the fish and the amount of fish over the gaff. I would 100% like the option of having the gaff. But if it comes down to gaffing a fish or netting a fish and taking time or fish away, I 100% support the not taking the time or the fish limit and increasing it to four and no closure in the season. Thank you.
Anybody have anything counter to what we've heard so far?
I'm just recreational. I'm not charter.
You don't mind. Okay, real quick. And then, okay. It's getting late, so.
My name's Aaron. I work during the week, so I appreciate that we had a later meeting this year. I didn't have to take time off to come voice my opinion. Pretty much, I mean, I get out, you know, 20 times because I'm working during the week. I like the fact of having a full season. I would like the fact or like to have the, you know, one fish per person with, you know, like a 4 or 6 boat limit because I don't get to go out as much. Weather is a factor for me too, you know. So on top of taking the weekdays off, then you got to figure in weekends. So, and then for the gaff, I mean, take or leave it, but I think you should let the angler choose whatever they feel safest with, you know. And that's it. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. One more. Well,
two more.
You were next.
My name is Chris DeMasi. I'm a charter captain. I also work at Boater's Warehouse, and that's actually what I'm going to be talking about tonight. With last year's limitations on our cobia fishing, I went and crunched some numbers. In June, our sales with cobia-related material, a.k.a. bucktails, hooks, gaffs, line, rods, reels, nets, in June, our sales were down 9%. In July, our sales were down 12%. In August, 21%. September, after the season was closed, 37%. You know, that averages out to 19.75%. You know, we're a small company. We only do, you know, we make our money, but that kind of a loss hit us hard. You know, and that kind of loss is being based on people that we don't even have any representation with. You know, this council, the South Atlantic, we have no representation. They're telling us how to live our lives. Working at the store, personally, I see between about 75 to 100 people a week, maybe, you know, and they all know I'm about cobia, and they ask me, and I ask them. And probably one out of eight of those people are actually cobia fishing. A lot of the guys just don't want to deal with it anymore. An even bigger aspect, though, is we did sell other items for other fisheries, a lot more of those, which worries me because here we are constricting ourselves on a fishery that is nowhere near being in danger and putting more pressure on a fishery that could be or is. So it just bothers me that this council or the VMRC will not take into the effect that the South Atlantic is governing us with no representation. You know, the numbers, I'm not going to argue. You all know them. The biggest thing is we have constantly been the most restrict. If we restrict any more this year, they're going to say our numbers went even higher again next year, and then we're going to have to try and restrict again. You know, the South Atlantic says one fish per person. Why? Let's go back to that. That's all I'll have.
We do have representation on the committee for cobia in the South Atlantic.
Not voting.
Yeah. So that was last year's, one of last year's. So we've always had representation. What happened was I checked into it. My predecessor, well, Jack Travis did, was the representative. But management issues were not really going on all the years that he was the representative. But starting last year, I elected to start going to those meetings.
Just to be vote.
Okay. And we also have North Carolina.
That's good.
North Carolina also is part of that.
So yeah, North Carolina is not Virginia.
No, but I'm down there, okay?
So yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's fine. We'll squeeze you in.
They have three voting members, correct? And how many do we have? We have
the same difference.
We have one.
Yeah. So it's not equitable. We have representation, just not equitable.
Yes, sir. Your name, please.
Good evening. I'm Captain Allen Alexander. I own York River Charters. I fished the Chesapeake Bay for about 40 years. Our fishery is the healthiest I've seen it in my lifetime for the species cobia. I'm not going to beat to death the numbers. I think everybody's in agreement that we've got less pressure a year later. Yet our harvest numbers supposedly have tripled.
Yeah,
we'll leave that alone. The only other thing I will say, time is of the essence, gentlemen. One of the young men, these young bucks here or something, they've all went to site. Us chummers, we're trying to catch up with them. But the bookings are unbelievable. Our customers are an educated customer, gentlemen. They have access to the internet. They know when actions are stalled. They saw what happened last year. Well, Skip, if we come down, they're not going to change the regulation on us, are they? We're still going to be able to at least get a fish in the boat and take it home with us, aren't we? Now, this year, my calls are down considerably, and I keep extremely accurate marketing numbers. They're down significantly on phone calls due to concern. The ones that are calling, Skip, maybe we ought to put this off until we see what these folks are going to do. Because if we can't at least take one home, it ain't no use me getting a hotel for a week, paying for restaurants for a week, getting advance tickets to Busch Gardens, and all the other side things that are going with these fishing trips. So, again, I know you want to make a decision in a timely manner, but please take into consideration our livelihood for this year is at stake on what happens over the next few weeks. We need a decision in a short amount of time to save this year.
We do appreciate it. We really do. Thank you. All right. If there's no other counter information, anybody else have anything that you really need to get through tonight?
I would like to ask Rob to reiterate the commission meeting where this will be discussed, the date, if you know it, and also if we have a feel for the next DEFMAC meeting beforehand.
Well, Jeff needs to decide about the next meeting. March 28th is the decision from the public hearing. The more I think about it, you heard Bill Gorham. I think the last 2 years, the North Carolina staff has not had a recommendation for the North Carolina Commission. Based on what went on last year, the circumstances are a little different now. I'll think about it a little bit more, but I think as we get to the March Commission meeting, we'll probably have some selections rather than just one finite recommendation. So we'll try to have a number of selections because we're hearing different ideas. We're hearing, I think mainly we hear a little bit tonight that status quo, as far as the measures go, we also hear a little bit on if you're going to shorten the season, it all depends on what you're doing, if you take the time off the front or the back. So we're going to have to accommodate some various options for the commission, and the commission's a veteran, having endured 5 hours last year or 4 hours and a half, something like that. They certainly know the issues very well, and so this will be a situation where the commission will look at some options, and they may or may not like those options.
And what happens if Virginia does status quo next year? Are they allowed to do that?
Yeah, nothing happens. You know, I'm
because
not
after next year, we'll have real data from mandatory reporting,
right,
plus non-compliance numbers, to put a bound on the error for it.
You know,
if people comply.
Turn off when you start talking about reporting. A certain segment of any fishery turns off when you start talking about reporting. But reporting is beneficial. It has been used in, I can't get the exact year, but I'll say about 1999, 2000, Maryland used its logbook for their charter fishery, and the ASMFC agreed that that was a better set of data than MERS, which is the old MRIP. So it does have practical use. It's also been used in assessments. The South Carolina logbook data was used in the last assessment. So I hope the enthusiasm over reporting just becomes continuous because, you know, we're going to help along the system a little bit. Ryan and Joe have been working on this, and we'll probably simplify the reporting. Right now we have it just one item. We have if you have a vessel or if you are a private or if you're a charter, you know, all different permits. We're going to simplify all that because the real need here is to get information on the fish. So thank you for bringing up the reporting. I think we're ahead of the other states in the Atlantic Migratory Group of Cobia. I think it works to our benefit. I don't have a solid idea on what it means if we have another year that MRIP says we had a very high harvest, because I'm convinced the measures we put in last year were conservative. The season, maybe that, you know, If everyone here thinks that July and August generally are the time for cobia, maybe there should be a little give there. But then at the same time, things will change in 2018 the way things are going on. So we have to be mindful of that. If the ASMSC gets involved, which they are, and if the ASMSC comes up with some sort of allocation situation, which they're starting, and if that starts off 2018 and the South Atlantic Fishery Management Council still has a very reduced ACL, which I'll call a quota, then even if we get a decent percentage of the states, it's not going to be a lot of fish. And that's the kind of direction we're heading. And those of you who've been around the ASMSC notice that once you're in a plan like that, it is truly compliance. And you have to, if you go over, you have to make amends. So, you know, that's the way things are right now. Good, bad, or however.
Okay, I have no problem with having a meeting if you think it'll do some good.
I think we're going to need to talk to the rest of the committee in the meantime. I mean, I think what happened is it's been since September since we had a meeting. I saw the same thing happen with the Crab Management Advisory Committee last week.
So let's have one.
If you weren't there.
What's out of town?
We can't do it. Mr. Chairman, we can't do a motion, but can we at least do a consensus that pretty much what we heard was,
yes,
you know, one fish per person, four fish per boat, no closure, and make the gaff optional?
Well, I don't think.
Ryan's going to present a summary of the meeting tomorrow. Even though you don't have a quorum, yes, you can let the commission know what you're thinking at this time. You know, and that's fine.
But they're not going to make a decision. They're not going to make any decision at this point. All right. Yeah, I don't think everybody thought about the whole how many. We didn't actually ask the question and ask how many people wanted these particular set of regulations. So
I think you're okay for
let's.
If you have a March meeting, I think that's going to be better.
Do you guys have a problem with coming back in March? Is it worth it to you?
Can it be later at 6 or like the worst people?
It's always at 6. It's always at 6.
The commission meeting's the one during the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the one we can't change.
Yeah, our meetings, it's always at 6.
So you can have a meeting the night before the commission.
That's fine. Let's do it.
Or the week
March
before.
March 27th. No, we're not.
Yeah, start the agenda with that will be the cobia. Yeah, and then we'll get to what is it? What else? We didn't get to one tonight.
Sturgeon.
Sturgeon.
Sturgeon update.
Can that wait till next month?
Yeah. We hope you can.
All right.
Motion to adjourn?
I think we adjourned on the forum.
Yeah,
we don't even take consensus.
So
we have a motion in a second.
Do you have any plan on trying to get any type of hearing season for Virginia?
You can download it on the web.
Every state that's put in for it has gotten it.
Find the link.
Because we didn't ask them on this particular ride, they didn't get the center. Tom was saying 30% to 60% increase in everything, not just COVID. Every single fish in any of our studies.